It's the first leg of the human thought on how matters and its jargon. But for me, the difference between science and technology is that it's quite reader friendly. Other things which have to sensitize me, but listen, that committee is not about prescription of tablets, TDS. You are here to, you are here to do. When I said, why do you say that about prescriptions? I said, yeah, I know you have to work. What is that thing to do? That is, he said, very pretty. I said, okay, leave it, you won't know. But the profound message, I think, must always be in our minds as members, honorable members and also from the department, is that our brief, among other things, it is to empower our communities about politics of health, which people really think that health is only about tablets and injections. Health has got its own ideological and political, and which I think is going to be important in ensuring that we continue with the work of the fourth parliament. But fifth parliament is quite challenging in its work because communities are expecting more and better. When we adjourned yesterday, there were two questions that were asked, and we then said we then allow the department to the duty just on those. I think it's important that we start to back to respond to that so that when we then go into the new the presentation for today, we are then able to discuss with that. Time for today, the latest will be fine. I don't have a problem with it being here until 8 o'clock. I don't have a problem. But it doesn't mean that we are going to to run a marathon. We are to ensure that we exercise these presentations, the presentations that are going to assist us to pay our oversight. And therefore, being attentive, the focus is then going to be very important. Welcome everybody, and those that are not here yesterday. Did you, the two questions that were asked before you start the presentation, I think I want you to thank you.
Good afternoon, honorable members. The other question that you responded to about coming community and telemedicine. The question that I would still respond to is about the state of need and the risk of loss of HR. And so I wanted to premise this if members allow me after I first referring to the sessions that are offered to the national level. Section 36 is the one that makes provision for the benefit of me. But I just wanted to raise a few of these provisions, just to give a sense of what this is about. It's about achieving consistency of health services in terms of national, provincial, and municipal planning, but also to promote equitable distribution and rationalization of health services and resources in such a way that we can address the problem of inequities that are based on racial, gender, economic, and geographical factors. This is what is providing for in there. But it's fair to say that we need to promote an appropriate mix of public and private health services and the demographic and epidemiological profile, as well as the potential advantages and disadvantages of the existing public and private health services, particularly for the affected community. It goes on to say that we need to protect or advance persons or categories of persons designated in terms of the employment of CDS and potential benefits of research and development with respect to improvement of health service delivery, but also to ensure that ownership of facilities does not create less incentive for health service providers and health workers. It also says that if applicable, the quality of health service is better rendered. I think it emphasizes that as well as the financial sustainability of health establishments and facilities. It goes on to say that we need to ensure the availability and appropriate utilization of human resources and health technology. And whether the private health establishment is for profit or not, do it, there are NGO facilities. It also refers to compliance with the requirements of certificate of non-compliance. So these are the basis on which it would be provided. But it says when we make recommendations, honorable members, we must consider certain conditions, and it specifically refers to vulnerable populations. And vulnerable populations, it says them as people with disabilities. It says groups such as women, older persons, children, and people with disabilities. So our understanding was that in looking at the demographic profile, we have to look at whether disabled people are going to, does it advance access to services for them or not? Older people, does it disadvantage them in any way in access to services, women and children? Now I'm premising this response with respect to this to the provision of the Act, specifically because the kind of response we got was triggered by the article that was in the Times. And our interpretation of that article is that, one, it is misleading, two, we think that it also misleads us in a way, because there's nothing in the Act that suggests that for the existing providers who are where they are located now, that you're going to approve them from where they are and to better them elsewhere. Because if you read section 21-22 of the Constitution, it says the answer. So I do not think it was the intention of the legislature to write a law that would be unconstitutional. And in any event, I don't even think it would have been passed, but that is my understanding. However, what we have tried to do is that we consult all the different professionals, because it defines health establishment. Health establishment is provided for here. But it also makes reference to health agencies. When we look at health establishment, it's actually a very broad definition. It includes both public and private sector facilities, meaning this specific provision will apply equally to the public sector as it will apply to the private sector. It is also about how we plan for resources, what we've been discussing today, how do we make sure that people access it. So we invited all health professionals in the country to just get a sense of how they see the implementation in a manner that can advance access. But that will also help us deal with the burden of disease. Honorable members on the chair, we shared the data of what the burden of disease is. And I want to use a particular example. We said in the country, the burden of disease in a set maternal mortality concern. It has gone down from 300 to 269, like we showed in the strategic plan yesterday. But you also know that of the 269, 50% of that are elderly people who died in our facilities. The others die actually at home or in the community. But we say we can intervene and do something about those who come to facilities. But for those who don't, are there any other mechanisms that we can consider whereby other services may be available that we can rely on or we can work that can be the basis of us issuing a certificate of need? But we've also asked the question about, because we've also counted the number of professionals that we have in the country, we know exactly where every single professional is. We also know where not the practice, not actual individual. Because individuals register with a statutory body. But the statutory body can't tell you at any point in time whether they're in practice or not. Our statutory bodies are not able to tell us also whether the doctor's practices are licensed or not, because they have not done it before. So in this country, if you want to know whether a doctor practices guidance or not, you have to go to the Board of Health and the Health Professions Council does not license practices. So you can never know at any point in time where the practices of doctors are, so that you can say people should access them. I think that's the first thing that we need to do. Second, because we don't know about those practices, we don't know what the policy is. If we want to regulate doctors, for instance, we unless they show us a license of practice, a person can say, yes, I'm a professional, but they also need to show us their practice. Now, if you want to catch people, that's another mechanism that we have, and that exists, and that's a big problem. But we ask a very important question to say, if you want the vulnerable groups that are reflected in the area, women, children, people with disabilities, and the elderly, let's take that point. If we want to improve access for them, what are the mechanisms? And if you say women need access to gynecologists and obstetricians, as an example, how best can we do that? And is there a mechanism that we can use? So some of them came up with some innovative ideas. So say maybe one option can be that they do rounds or they go to a particular facility on certain days and not on certain days. So we said perhaps what we need to do is to look at innovative ideas on how we can advance access. And our reading of the act here was not written to the punitive act. It was not written to punish us professionals nor to close citizens. We saw it actually differently as a mechanism of advancing citizens. And constitutionally, I don't think we can wake up one day and just close our citizens. It's not possible. We like when we say move away today and go to relevance. But we have to ask professionals how best can they help us ensure that services are available. Last week we had a group, all doctor groupings, discussing doctor groupings, the discussing convention, SANA, the IPA, all groupings. We had a meeting with them. They said to us, give us written input on how best we can address this. Now the IPA came up with a very interesting model. They say even though there's no license, they have started themselves an accreditation system among their members. We send them with license services so that we can learn from this. We also met the pharmacist chair. They said to us they would like to start seeing, for instance, they use Soweto as an example. Soweto has a very big population. But for even the few pharmacies better there, some of them close down. You could actually, they didn't even go beyond 10. Now, it means if you want medicines and the clinic do not have the medicine and you want one closer, you can't. We said we do not limit this to health professionals. We also think that the NGOs that are providing services will also be included in the certificate of need if they fit the definition of health establishment. We met again a chair, another group, we met a dentist. The dentist made a proposal that they would like to make proposals about the two box. They say, and this is on record, that they have actually established that government tends to buy equipment expensive than they do in a private sector. And for the amount of money that it could have saved, they have rendered services. Some have actually opted to say that they can even come and do sessions. Others said, have some patients, if it's convenient, can come to their facility. So we've noted those things. We also met another group of all the allied health professionals, physiotherapists. These are consultations that took place yesterday that were disrupted by the petrol bomb by this individual. That's what I was saying yesterday. Today the team was meeting specialists, NGOs, we are also meeting labor, we are meeting all groupings, the users of services, the beneficiaries of services, we'll be meeting the disability groups, we'll be meeting women organizations, we'll be meeting organizations that represent children. So we are going to meet all stakeholders so that we can get a sense of what they are understanding every single day, the regulations of the people.
I think members have got a response. On my side, as we are all new members in this committee, is that it is very possible for us to get a the act, so that we raise, we familiarize ourselves with it. I don't know whether it's between the committee section or parliament, or if we can be associated with that, I would appreciate it if the level member of the professional committee can have the copy of it before the act. Having said that, can we then now go to our presentation for today, and then hand over to you again. Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members. Chair, the member is the ACT structure is a working system. I will take you through a program one. Just to reflect on what was suggested in the economy in Asia as well as the target. So we still have to be the 3 year period. It was from that perspective that we started. Chair, I have distributed, I know that it's not an open data issue, but I thought I should leave this behind a copy of the intervention that we have started this additional work with the province to try and help them achieve a good audit outcome. This is about ensuring effective financial management and accountability by improving audit outcomes. Now, the first problem with this is that we have written into our annual performance plan that we'll achieve these audit outcomes, which are really provincial audit outcomes. We're committing to that because we this is our mission. We cannot run health if we just have good audit outcomes at national and the problems in the province. Precisely because the budget, like I said, 90% of the budget is what is allocated to provinces in the form of conditional grants. So we decided then to share with the provinces the burden of meeting good audit outcomes. Since we won't be able, it will always be a race for us, but it's a commitment on our part to do more to help the provinces around their audit outcomes. So as an effort to do this, we shared with you, and the minister mentioned yesterday that we recruited unemployed graduates and this team allocated to different provinces. And we were sharing with you some of the gains in some of the provinces and some of the hospitals, particularly with the revenue collection. In particular, you see, I want to go through the different steps, but also I'd like to see a few examples maybe in the steps that were distributed. But these are provincial technical support official programs. We did it specifically because we'd like to improve the audit outcomes. We may not achieve that, but we said we committed. In this class, I won't do the full presentation, but I'd just like to refer you to a few slides. A slide that refers to revenue collection, ICT results and associated outcomes. Now, when we started the audit report of the problem, what came out was that there were three key problems. One was on assets, the second was on revenue, and the third was on HR. So we targeted those three areas to see whether it supported the process, whether it would make a difference. Just on revenue, if you go to slide number 10, you realize that for this process where we started, there's still a problem with the under collection, but the differences are small in some processes but significant in others. But what we are going to be doing in this financial year is put in more effort and resources, and I'll come back to this specific provision and some of the experiences. If we check, we'll be able to at least make improvements, but the most significant for us
the bill for the Central Hospital, the honorable members. Let for the honorable members, for the Central Hospital, there's only one that struggles with achieving the target, but all of them have already passed the target that was established. So it shows that with this process, even with this commitment of unrighteous audit, we are confident it will be achieved. But we started by saying at least for the first year, if it will just get three problems. Because at the moment, it's only two, it's Northwest and Western Cape. So we would like to have three more, so that they have five. So we are committing that we would like to invest in three more, so that for the three we achieve a great outcome. So this is the background which we wanted to share with you. The other, I know that you mentioned the non-negotiables, but we'd like also to have an opportunity to discuss the non-negotiables with you, because it's a tool that has a dashboard that if used even by yourself will help us to ensure that there's sort of a checks and balance, because we can check whether a problem in the first place is allocated for vaccine, allocated for ARV, so that if they overspend, then either the problem should be because they under allocated, not because they were no control. We use that tool for assisting with allocation, but we also measure whether the funds have been used appropriately or not. So it's a very useful tool. And it may be also for ourselves, and we'd like to also share it with you, and if you allow us a share, we will share that with you. The next one is about ICT governance. This is very specific to the systems that are in the department. It's not for a sector-wide purposes. It's also not for a transfer, for systems that are in the policies. This is for BAS, for lobbies, and for our HEPA system. Just to ensure that we've got a governance structure. And it's also for a system that we hope at national level, the district health information system. We are in phase one of implementation, but we want to see that, particularly with regard to this disaster recovery plan. The other says about communication. We've always maintained that communication is not just about what is in the media. Because we are intending to start a process of promoting the media side, we would like to start the strategy of investing in communication, and particularly communicating health messages. And we've been in consultation with different civil society commissions, professional groups, as well as the patient groups. Now, the patient groups are the ones who represent the patient interest. Like, for instance, the Hypertension Society, the Heart Foundation, the Diabetes Society, who are working with these particular groups to see whether we can reach out on messages. We just started with the Heart Foundation. Now, we hope that as part of that, we go beyond just the level of media, for instance, the community has messages. There are international things that are linked to diseases, some health topics. For instance, for the National World AIDS Day, all of us know that it's the 1st of December, we have World TB Day, and so on. Now, the criticism that you had before is that people only get to know just closer to those things, that, oh, it's TB, it means it's closer to World TB Day. So the proposal has been that we need to communicate this throughout the year, not just when they are treatment. So we'd like to correct those, and hopefully we'll reach out to as many people as possible. The other important one, the minister spoke about infection control, but we've also had that the washing of hands is significant in so many ways. not just for high heat measures, but as a transmission of disease. And it's one thing that we have not even put effort on, and they showed us effort that we can reduce neonatal as well as infant mortality just through the campaign on hand washing. So those are basic examples that we've been, you know, we've been discussing and we'd like to start sharing something. The next one is about a human resource strategy. We came up with a strategy and we've been in discussion, and perhaps Dr. Carter can just share with you the effort to try and bring normative work into what we do. We've not had in the past yet the ratio split between, for a facility, what is a good mix of doctor-nurse ratio, or a good mix of administrative versus professional, or even technical. So we just finished that exercise and we're in the process of implementation. But we did that up to primary care level. We're starting the next phase for all the hospitals. What it means here is that we must have a norm and a standard that says a theater must have so many theater trained nurses. An ICU must have so many, depending on the number of beds. So that's where we have finished. But what we would like to do is to say that every province must move towards meeting those norms. Because from the preliminary where that we come, for some provinces there isn't an objective criteria of saying, okay, we're moving people to the facility. Some facilities have an oversupply of personnel, others have an undersupply. And we also, when we have the conference on the midwifery, we hope that, you know, sometimes these days nurses don't want to go to labor wards because they see the punishment or maternity wards, because so we want to go back and see what is normative, how many nurses should be in maternity, in labor wards, and so that standard is complied with without compromise. So we have finished that work, and we will be following up with regard to implementation. We did this with all the HR people in all the provinces. So all of them are familiar with the tools that we developed, and we did this with the support of the Western organization. Like I said yesterday, we also introduced the employee wellness program, which is required in terms of MCAT, because you are assessed also based on that, on how well you look after employees as well. Chair, under leadership, we already mentioned that we'd like to change. Like I said, in the National Health Act, Section 19 of this Act is very specific. It requires of us to have integrated plan, meaning we don't develop a plan at national and the provinces. So it's integrated, we meet the provinces and we have joint training, so that there's a consistency in the plan between national and every province. So meaning, after you look at our plan, you must be able to see some of the activities in the provincial plan, because we have that planning approach on an ongoing basis. Where we have not made considerable progress is planning with other government departments. For instance, we have picked up as an example the examples that I shared with you yesterday, that if we know that lack of access to clean water contributes to diarrheal diseases, we must meet and raise the plan with water affairs and so on. So that is still the next step that we will be reaching. The next one, Chair, is having a forum on the consultation. Meaning, we should not just have one of consultation with stakeholders. Because we tend to see that if you consult stakeholders one, sometimes the message does not reach their members and constituencies. So we would like to have a standing forum in different provinces that we can use as a vehicle for consultation and communication. But even this forum must be representative. They should not just be, people who can do not have a constituency. So we take you from, again, the Less Than Health Act, because it makes certain references, particularly with regard to the statutory bodies, that you must have a standing forum of a statutory body where we meet on a regular basis to see whether our laws are in sync and whether we're implementing them. We are also using this as a chance, if you allow me, to promote a regulatory government. So that I know that there's a reference in some of the concerns that the powers of the DC in terms of this act are arbitrary and there's too much power. And we've explained that the remedy actually can be through regulatory government. When you actually have this forum to discuss when you draft regulation, you consult, but you also have an ongoing engagement with different stakeholders. So, Chair, just for this conference, the budget amount that should be voted for by $399, and this is the breakdown of this budget. It's mainly administrative, and it's the Minister's Office, my office, the DGG's, the finance and corporate. For the second area, and this is on the National Health Insurance Health Planning and Engagement, the purpose is to improve access to quality and medicine through development and implementation of policy to achieve universal coverage, health financial reform, integrated health system planning, supporting monitoring, evaluation, and reform. Chair, under this, like the Minister said yesterday, that we have the working class following which there will be a legislative program, after that there will be a funding long term. The first one is the white paper, and the minister, I guess, will announce when this will happen. We've been in consultation with Treasury, and Chair, I would like to use the words of the member yesterday about how that we can reallocate for primary health care and provision. Our view is that in South Africa in particular, before we even ask for additional money, my view is that we have enough to do some work given the constraints that we have. And I want to use that as an example to say that if we reconfigure the way we do budgeting, and if honorable members, you read the report of FFT, you realize that in fact, FFT says under allocation in primary allocation is a problem. And it is that under allocation that we'd like to address. If we redirect the way allocation is done for district, allocation is done for primary health care, just reconfiguring that budget at provincial level, I think we can make a huge difference without asking for extra money. And this is what we're asking. And we're saying we have to change the way allocations are made. And that's probably going to be the start, and this is where we want to start, so that by the time we have anyone in discussion with Treasury, this modality that we are talking about is what we are discussing, so that when you create a fund, it might be informed by that modality. And Treasury has put together a discussion with members on finance, and what we want is to ensure that there's a sync between the Treasury finance assessment and the health document that is about employment. Chair, the next one is about regulating the private health sector. We will await the outcome of the the work that the Competition Commission is currently undertaking of the market inquiry. They are investigating the cost of healthcare in the private sector. And we will await the outcome, and based on that, we'll then establish the commission, and based on that, we'll then say what the commission will have to regulate. We're hoping that we'll get the results as soon as they are done, because for now, we just write this as an intention so that once the results are out, we can, but we will not start the work. But in the meantime, we do have the pricing committee on pharmaceuticals. the problem that we have, Chair, is that in the National Health Act, we actually have a provision that deals with the reference pricing. But it was struck off through a court action, and now there's no provision. We don't have a provision in the National Health Act for reference pricing or whatever, for what is set in the price. So, as a result, we said we can only do that on the basis of WEC from the price information. The other option here is that we amend the law to make those provisions. This rest of the same law. But in amending, it must still be objectively determined. We've seen the effect of pricing on pharmaceuticals, that it has made medicines affordable, and for other areas, obviously, we'll have to do that. We've seen the data from the Council for Medical Team, the cost of healthcare in the private sector, and on the basis of that, we think that perhaps the some intervention that is needed. We are currently working on the logistics fee, and this is the distribution fee when the manufacturers get products. The distribution company or the food dealer, what they charge when they get a message from the manufacturer, they distribute them to doctors or they distribute them to pharmacies and so on. In the Latin America, the margin ranges anything between 8 and 10% in most of the European countries. So this is what proposal, and we do have the draft regulation that will be sent to us. As a civil aid price, there will be adjusted methodology. These prices are adjusted on an annual basis. For instance, if there's a foreign exchange effect, for instance, say the rent value changes, it affects the price in some way. So we then revert back to the company to see what the adjustments are. So there's that kind of engagement with us about the prices. And this normally affects the local companies, and it does for the multinationals, those that produce their products in local. The next is about management and control of pharmaceuticals. And the point of government is that we have an essential medical group. We work with a professional association to produce the formula. And I'd like to take this opportunity to say that a formula actually serves more as a information, because it tells you more about a particular medicine. While the essential drug must be linked to a treatment guideline, it tells you that this is how the disease is treated, and in relation to that, these are the products that must be given. And then you then, in relation to that, give a formula, but then you want to know more about those particular products.
What you are saying, formula, is it what was called mint?
No, mint is self-saving. Mint is produced by companies, tell you about the prices. The formula is produced by the, in South Africa, it's only produced by South African Medical Association. It's written SAMF. It's called SAMF. Yes, so if you have your EDL and you have treatment guidelines, you read that with the formula.
Is it what is what you find in a, if you go in the OPD, you find that in the doctor's book, this is the X-ray, this is the medicine, how the doctor
This is the MDR, medical death reference. So there are a lot of the, but what we always advise is that if you have the EDL, essential medical list, you also have the, if you have treatment guidelines, you must also have the formula, so that you use the treatment. It has been developed by the South African Medical Association. Chair, for the chronic dispensing, the minister explained yesterday that we have started a program in food distribution is one particular initiative was started in Kids and Me, which I thought I could share with you. They were using the church actually, and the mosque, where I on a Sunday when people go to church, when they finish, they can get their next donation. We that actually could even develop a plan whereby as they collect, but if they have a trained professional there, they can also be educated about their medicine, about health and other things. We're planning this intervention in KZN to see how well it has worked. In Western Cape, they use the private provider for that, but the model in Western Cape is also another interesting one in that what they do, as you collect your medicine, they also test you. If you are diabetic, they check your sugar level immediately as they give you medicine. If you've got hypertension, they also check whether you are hypertensive. Because sometimes when you collect your medicine, you don't know whether what your state is at that time, even though you've been sick. So these are two examples, but we've already started. We started with ARV initially. At the end of May, we already enrolled 50,000 patients. So we're hoping that by the end of the year, we have 500,000 patients enrolled in the program, which will not just be for HIV, but for TB, for hypertension, for diabetes, and so on. So we'll give you feedback on how well the program is doing. The revenue collection, I mentioned that, but I want to ask Dr. Carter, we want to strengthen revenue collection by incentivizing central hospitals. So this one, even though we show that you collected well, but we want to encourage them to do more. Now, Dr. Carter he is the former CEO of Protestant and Tigerhead. He ran both hospitals. And he's helping us now to do for their hands. And I want to give him an opportunity just to share with you what this is. Yes.
So just a short while, did you also run the Rikos Hospital? But just to indicate, just to indicate that all the patients that are seen in the health system chair are classified in terms of their income, either at age naught, which means patients who don't pay or cannot afford to pay for their health care, the poor or the indigent. Then depending on the income, the age 1, age 2, age 3, meaning private. So people are classified in terms of the ability to pay for health services. Now, tertiary health services, specialized health services are were never intended to be free for those people who can afford to pay. So lots of people who are in fact working, in fact some people are still very rich, make use of our specialized health services. And in the central hospital in particular, we talk about highly specialized services. Some of the services that are not even available in private sector, in private hospitals. And many of the people that are treated in these hospitals have a medical aid. Also, there are government departments that would normally send patients, who have the option to send patients to a state hospital or to a private hospital. When the patients are sent, for example, for correctional services to a private hospital, private rates are paid. But when they come to a state hospital, very often the state hospitals don't bill. So you can have a medical aid, go to a state hospital, and your medical aid does not pay for your care. So in fact, medical aids get away with millions of rands because the hospitals are not collecting the revenue that are due to them. So if you in fact go and check how much money is owed to hospitals, it's hundreds of millions of rands across the country. So there's one of the reasons why hospitals don't really worry about collecting the money is because it isn't really previously there was not an incentive, because if you collect the money as a hospital, the hospital goes into the general fiscus, into revenue, the same as you pay tax. There's therefore no direct incentive of hospitals. But what has happened in the Western Cape, as an example, is hospitals have been allowed to retain some of that revenue. Initially it was 50% and more recently 100% of the revenue. So the revenue that's collected, 100% of this is retained. But because it's on a yearly basis, money is used to improve the health services at the local level. So as an example, a hospital like Tageburg or Kruderskier on its own would collect on a yearly basis anything from 120 to 150 billion rand. And you can imagine what a hospital can do with more than 100 million rand in terms of buying equipment, improving the hospital, generally improvements to hospital to the value of more than 100 million rand. Now that is what is possible. It can even become much, much more if one incentivizes hospitals by allowing hospitals to retain the revenue. Now, DG earlier referred to an initiative that we had with the World Bank where we supported Central Hospitals and the amount of money that we were able to increase the revenue by. We spoke of one hospital that increased the revenue by between 40 and 60 million rand just by one initiative. Now that's a significant input into the health system by increasing revenue income. So in fact the strategy used by the private sector are the same strategy used in these institutions, appointment of what is referred to as case managers, and they use the same sort of system that one normally use from business point of view to ensure that if you have a medical aid, you go to a state hospital, your medical aid will pay. So that's an initiative which is working, and we believe that it can work in the rest of the country.
Initiative. It's just to show you for the central hospital. If you notice, there are four that are not included. It's only six that we have actually the central hospital. We don't have two from Jesus and we don't have two from Western Cape. That's the case. It's because they're already collecting and they actually generate quite a lot. KZN, they have two different models. They've got the Chief Advocate Hospital, which operates completely on different principles, and King Edward. So what we're trying to do is to see how we can bring the two principles, I mean the principles, the two institutions. So we will be including them as soon as possible. But we also wanted to head up and put this as a good practice, a model on revenue collection. But the other initiative we started implementing, and you can see that there is progress, and we can still do more. But what we still do not have, Sharon, is that a hybrid for retention. We would like a consistent with project of Mesela yesterday. How do you then take a model and improve the performance? And we'd like to see whether the retention of revenue can be the best solution to get that revenue back into an institution for it to improve its services. But that will go hand in hand with the delegation that provinces give to those hospitals. Because if it's for delegation, they'll be able to do something. And we're hoping that could inform us as we go along what the best model is. The next chapter is about developing business and enterprise architecture. We developed the inner strategy and the system of the garbage code. We've all checked all the systems that have been used just by way of the country. We spend, and when I say we, I mean the health sector as a whole, not the national department, over 4 billion shares, but we don't have integrated systems. So here's an opportunity for us to assess which systems work and which ones don't. And the preliminary results that were presented to us last year showed us that there were still systems that were running on very, very old. You know, when we started computers a long time ago, based on DOS and WebConnect, there were some that were still running on them. So we need to really get rid of the weak process. But we also would like to have a much more responsible approach. Say, if there's an investment of over 4 billion on these systems, do we further improve them? We can't just throw them in the rubbish because there's a lot of investment. But if we need a much more objective approach as to how we maintain those systems and ensure that they can serve us better. So we've been working with the Department of Science and Technology, CIR, as well as the ESF, I think those two So we will be getting the results of the OOP and the recommendation and lesser than 10 people from the Chair, the next one under the book is about the National Health Tax Observation. We have just finished auditing all our research initiatives in South Africa. We got a database of all tax records collected in South Africa. And the proposal is that we should set up an observatory so that when we have difficult questions, we can have a mechanism by which we can conduct research, come up with innovative solutions that can help us solve certain problems. Now, the WHO has actually recommended that we should set up a convention. Now, in particular, it's also in relation to the question that was raised yesterday. One as to whether South Africa can have its own pharmaceutical manufacturer. Just by way of background, I've done an international study on technology transfer in local for pharmaceuticals, for diagnostics and for vaccines. And in the African continent, South Africa still comes out best, but we didn't have to invest more. For instance, if you look at our R&D investment as a percentage of GDP, there is still a significant proportion. But we just need to then build research capacity. Now, to do that, we need a we then have this data, so there are these reports. The idea here is that for us to say you want to do local production, you must build your research capacity, you must build your R&D effort. And on the basis of that, we would like to set up an observation. And as part of that observation, we then identify which institutions that work currently, and then we promote engagement, not just amongst South African institutions, but also with international ones. So this is the fact that we have to start with the developing the database. We finish that, now we are going to work towards establishing the observation. So that's what we are going to do. The next one here is about a monitoring and evaluation. We'll be working with UTMB and the president so that we are free on these details. Because an area of importance for Panapu, for instance, certain rules we just have to monitor are just based on and what the UTMB is. For surveillance, there are certain notifiable medical conditions where by their outbreak, you need to know. And because of the international health regulations and the expectations globally, you know, disease is no longer know any boundaries. You can see with Ebola in West Africa. Now, if you have an outbreak like that, our system of notification has to be very, very active so that we can know how best to contain the epidemic but also respond to it. So what we're proposing is that we set up what we call the National Public Health Institute. We've got a draft bill, we'll be coming back to you with the draft bill, but also share with you the experiences of other countries. The next one is on HIV prevalence. We release the data on annual basis of what the prevalence rates are from every week, and we'll be sharing this with you, but we also good for helpers, and we will also be sharing that. On international treaties, there are two specific international instruments that South Africa is signatory to. The first one is the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. That one was beheaded actually by South Africa. It was the first country to lead in the world, and it's the basis on which the chair of the African Commission and the Minister of Government won an award. In fact, it was a South African award. We won an award as a country because of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. The second one, Chair, is the draft bill, which will be coming to Parliament with all international health regulations. Now, the law says that for every treaty, all of them before implementation must come from Parliament, so that Parliament must ratify them, or Parliament must translate them into local law and so on. So those are the two that you have. For bilateral cooperation, most of the bilateral cooperation are either with developed countries or with developing countries, where with developing countries we provide support, and with developed countries they provide a facilitatory funding which helps us for the implementation of our programs. So this is the budget, and in terms of this budget, I just wanted to highlight that there's about 600 million for this financial year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that if I may suggest that the DG completes the presentation, and then we can always pick up the points at the end, because we may get answers to our questions on the way through.
Well, we can just the third one is the HIV, AIDS, TB, maternal and child health. It's either decreased with the death of disease, like the minister presented yesterday, but also it like maternal child mortality and morbidity, optimized good health of children, adolescents and women. And that there are three overarching strategies to increase the guidelines, not standards, but also come up with targets. Now, all of these we have international obligations to report to the UN system. And it's part of the reason that we need to always make sure that the coherence in our strategy between what we do in HIV, AIDS, maternal health, in child health, adolescent women, because all these are intricately linked. If you look at, particularly with program 3, it's a very busy slide, and Chair will ask why this one is structured in this manner. It is structured in this manner specifically because we have had challenges in the past in the statistics in South Africa releases their recent census results, and when they release them, it's mid-year, and we already are midway through implementation of our plan. But by the time we report, we have completely new data. So what we decided is to reflect the numerator and denominator, because when StatsSA releases the results, it affects the denominator. And what it tends to do is that when we report, say we said we're going to do antenatal disease, for instance, our numerator will remain the same. Now, if our denominator changes, it may change our report on performance. It may show that we have underperformed, because our denominator came literally. So we would like to show you both with the adjusted figure and non-adjusted figure, so that it can be a much more objective report. And we would like to present the data in this manner if you allow. So we do that for, because it is not all indicators that are affected by sensor. It is these that we reflected that are affected by then suppose that deal with maternal mortality, neonatal mortality, and where we provide sexual and reproductive health, particularly with regard to contraception. And for those who would like to improve antenatal health. Now, Madam Chair, if you recall, when historically women go when they are pregnant to clinic, the experience that we see is that some women do not attend antenatal clinic, and they go when it's already late, and it also contributes to maternal mortality. It is for that reason that I said We know about women that die in our families, but we don't know about those who die in the community. It's those who don't understand in their family. For this reason, our work-based primary healthcare outreach team would like them to identify them and encourage them to attend the antenatal clinic. The second one is about the postnatal visits. Now, this is an area that we used to pride ourselves for the visits, the lessons. We used to call the ground suitcase lessons. In a particular house, that when you saw a ground suitcase, there was a baby born. And now that, we no longer have that. We are hoping that we can bring that back through the work base, because this is how we catch those women that never make it to the facility. This is the background to some of the interventions that we so that we also have community involvement in the way in which health services are provided. For neonatal mortality, we argue here that for every mother that dies, the chances of survival of the newborn is minimal. So our ability to save mothers will also save the newborn. So we would like to bring the two. Save mothers will save newborn. And we are asking that we want to reduce this rate at a rate from would like to reduce them. We are not seeing 40% per 1,000 life there. We'd like to reduce them to under 6. So it's a very ambitious target. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to do so in the chair. And the social and reproductive health is about contraception. One of the contributing factors in neonatal death is also about the young ones giving birth when they're not ready, because they don't survive neither TMCDT is one area where the world is asking us how we did it, and it really gives us pride that we've been able to reduce transmission, I mean from 8% to 2.0. So it has been quite significant. The minister has put figures to that, to say that we have reduced from so many thousands to about 8,000 now. So we still want to go even further below 1%, because reaching zero for us is an ideal. But we say even reaching below 1% would be a requirement. Can I go back to this? I didn't include infant mortality, and maybe we'll come later. The under 5 year, this is the one. Now, under 5 mortality, we went to the Rest University, and it's also linked to the meeting that we just had, because we wanted to do a countdown to MDG. In September, all countries will be reporting to the United Nations on how well we've done on MDG. Now, we try to put a face in human life. Just doing a rough calculation, if you calculate the number of, if we can intervene now, between now and let's say if we can intervene between now and the MDG, that was under 5 mortality. We would have saved the adult enrollment of students at UCT. So if you put it in that way, you can see the significance. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to do. But we can't get to you with the countdown so that we can also experiment on MDG, because when they announce, and as we do the countdown, because we are left with 500 days. In the 500 days, what are those things that we can do that will help us reach certain things? We may not reach the target, for instance, for maternal mortality, but we can reduce it to considerable levels, because that were a heavy. We've seen it can be done. In this case, for instance, they've been able, in a period of 1 year, reduce mortality by 40%. If they could do it, we can see whether they can do other problems. We'd like to improve our immunization coverage by showing that those babies that never made it to the clinic for immunization are brought, but also our facilities plan carefully and properly for vaccines. Because if they don't order vaccines, children won't be immunized. So we just want to make sure that we can achieve that. Our target is that for measles, we are putting at 82 for the second dose. We'd like to improve that. As you can see, we're doing well with the first dose. It's not a problem. Our program is with the 10 dose, which is sitting at 82%. We'd like that to end. So that margin of 9% for us, I mean, of 8%, is quite important. Check on the other for school health, like we said, for the learners with you screen them. And we've got grade 1 and grade 8. And we have targeted specifically in the first team the quintile 1 and 2. These are districts where the subject comes, or where the district and the communities that come from those districts are really below a certain level of poverty. And we say we want to start there so that they can be the ones who benefit first and we can implement them. Now for the preliminary work that we've done, shall we pick up some of the learning disabilities, hearing side and so on, and we'd like to go back and send the professionals. And this is one area, Chair, like I said, if you take children and you link it with the defeat of me, you can actually ask the professionals to go and just assist him for a specific period so that you improve the life of these children and their learning abilities. Because our view is that it can even change the results in school. Because we saw that others have serious side problems, some hearing problems, others just cognitive related problems. So we had a report and we find a solution of the children. For TB chair, we increase our detection rate by going into houses to pick up those families that need to be on treatment and are not. But also encourage those who are on treatment to finish treatment so that we prevent antimicrobial and prevent their having NDRs or FDRs. For correctional services, the minister has said that we have already started reports. A very high-tech equipment gene access, which is able to detect difficulty. In the past, a man said, in honor of members, people had to wait for weeks for their results. Two terms sent to the lab that hope to come back again. With gene access, they can wait 2 hours, within 2 hours they get their results, they know whether they have TB or not. But what is good is that they can also know whether they have MDR TB or not. So it's a very good system that helps us to develop. And I'm hoping that on the basis of this, we can do the TB program. The sooner we're on top of it, the best. And equally, for correctional services, is that because of overcrowding, TB is not just a medical problem. It's a social problem. It links to the social determinants of health. It's driven by overcrowding. If you don't deal with overcrowding, TB will be. So we need to deal with it. It's about poverty, we need to deal with it. It's about nutrition. So we have to also systematically deal with those problems. But for the correctional studies, if an inmate has TB, when they are released, they join their family. They spread to the family. So we have to treat them, ensure that when they join their family or community, they don't become yet another mechanism of spreading. So the third we are targeting them. We are also targeting the mining sector, like the minister said yesterday. Because TB in the mines, especially the gold mines, is a problem and it's driven by silicon. So if we treat lung related disorder, we can actually not only help the mine workers but also their tumors. Chair, for HIV, we also want to ensure that we deal with the comorbidity between HIV and TB. And treating them early so that they don't co-infection and also monitor them effectively. So these are the costs related to this problem. And this is probably one of the biggest problems financially. But the 12 billion that you see there is money that is a grant fund. These are funds that we allocate to problems. And I thought I should just mention so that you can see that the proportion of what it means at this time, it's quite a small amount. The next one is the human papilloma virus. It will be through a grant initially. If I go up to 4, I guess it's up, because at the moment we are doing 3, 4, and we'd like to do 3, 4, and 5. So that we can reduce any risk of cervical cancer. The next one is primary health care. The focus is to develop an overseas presentation of legislation, but also to have a uniform district health system, environmental health, communicable and non-communicable diseases, as well as health promotion. Here we would like to start by including the future government. The minister had mentioned yesterday our need to have proper government structure, including his committee, of the board. But I also need to mention that we work with the health system trust to look at the capacity of our managers in the clinic. We have a sense of what they're capable of and what they're not capable of in this initial record basis. And it's the basis on which we propose a program for their training. We start that with the CEOs, and Dr. Carter has been driving a program to train CEOs. And last year we trained how many programs? About 148 CEOs in our company. But because training is not the one thing, we need to have a follow-up and see whether is there any progress. And then it will take a lot of time, but we'd like to test in our studio. The next one is about the National Health Commission. The minister mentioned yesterday that we'd like to have this body, which will be headed by the deputy president. Now, if you look at our target, we were a little bit, how do I say, for because there's a, we've got 52 districts, and the 52 districts have 3,074 facilities. So we're in a way ambitious because we're saying 3,000 must have functional clinic committees by 2056. It is quite ambitious because it means it will only be 74 of the others. We were not in the first year, it is not even included in the district hospital. So we'll move to the district hospitals and the few remaining clinics in 2016. Chair, for the access to community-based we again are working on the principle of an ideal clinic, and with the ideal clinic, we're trying to just make sure that we meet the expectations of the users of care. When we came up with this concept, it's because we wanted to utilization of the institution. People must not move from one clinic and go to another because they are not getting with the service. Any survivor who goes to a clinic must get know what to expect, and the service must be the same. We must find those packages of services and so on. So we will be doing this project with the presidency, because it has a planning element so that we can roll it out throughout the whole country. Initially we said we'll start with 300 followed by 600 because it requires some investment. For port health services, I'd like Mr. Murewala to just give an update on how far we are with bringing them internationally so that we can be able to implement international health regulations once Parliament has passed the bill. The next one is about the environmental health. Yesterday I explained about the modern standards and the example of Rogan. To say that we've come up with regulations for healthcare, waste management, environmental health strategy, normal standards. It's just to implement and ensure the compliance. For that, we conducted the Sunday study, which was the basis on which we could tell what the data is about non-communicable diseases, tobacco, smoking. We still have a problem with the smoking, especially among the youth. We need to have more messages there. But there are a few specific areas where we can target the intervention. For instance, we picked up obesity because it doesn't require a lot of money. It's just to change our diet and encourage exercise. Patrick, like the Minister of Vincent, I had a bit to work with us, like Vincent, lunchtime we say let's walk and not eat or whatever. And bicycles. Yes, to say we don't ride, we don't go by car to Parliament, we ride bicycles.
Oh.
Don't prevent the sick. So those are some of things that we currently do.
chair for the next one is about malaria. This is one area, like I said yesterday, we are moving towards elimination, but our success will depend on how we work with Mozambique and funds. Population makes a and ask Dr. Kana to elaborate more. We've discussed the regulation. As you know, this is what has ever been the use of Kakata with a clear feather. What is it that will be agreed? So we've sent it out for comments. Once it's been finalized, we will come back with everything. Now there's two debates about whether we want to regulate the color of the ambulance, for instance. Whether we should have one number in the country, that is the emergency number. As Dr. Kakata will explain the difference between one using one number, not the other, why it is doing, why can't you use 1 and 2?
Chair, currently the problem with when you need an ambulance, to phone an ambulance, there are so many different numbers that one can phone or should phone. And not everyone, not the public don't necessarily know which number to phone if you need an ambulance. So everyone knows, for example, if you're in America, you phone 911. Irrespective of where you are in the country, you phone 911. In South Africa, the number you phone depends on where you live, which municipality you're in. Because even at municipality level, there are different numbers. At provincial level, there are different numbers. So the recommendation is, and it's already universally accepted, that 112 is a recognized universal number that should be used for emergencies. So that is the current recommendation. Now clearly there are major implications for communications and the responsibility for determining that is not in fact a Department of Health determination, but it's a Department of Communications determination. So we have made the recommendation, but we will be liaising with the relevant government departments, also local government has an implication for that, because it's not only about health services, it's about emergency services, which includes fire and rescue. So that is a recommendation that we have made, and we're in the process of consulting with relevant government departments to achieve that. I'm not sure, DG, whether you wanted me to comment on it. So as far as the regulations are concerned, Chair, currently, as far as emergency medical services are concerned, there are no standards, which means that you can use any vehicle to transport sick patients, and there's no standards that is set. And if you look at what is being used currently in the various places, both in the private sector as well as in the NGO sector and in the public sector, the type of vehicles are not regulated and standardized. People who manage emergency medical services are not regulated and standardized. And in fact, the training that is provided is also extremely limited, and I'll come to that in a minute. Also, the equipment that is available on ambulances are also not regulated, and also the ambulance stations that people work from are not necessarily regulated. So we have just concluded regulations that have gone out for publication and comment, which in fact that it does regulate. So let me start off with the ambulances, for example. So the specifications of what an ambulance should look like, what are the specifications, what are the dimensions, what are the things that go into an ambulance, how should an ambulance be fitted out, all of that is extremely spelled out in detail in terms of its specifications. Secondly, in terms of the people who work on ambulances, at the moment we have in the country 17,000 ambulance personnel. 11,000 of those are basic ambulance assistants. The basic ambulance assistant course is a very short couple of months course. And in fact, except for those people who are extremely experienced with many, many years of experience, there's very little that your basic ambulance assistant can do. So apart from changing bandages and putting on bandages, there's very little they can do unless they have a long experience. So we in fact are recommending that the training of ambulance personnel should be a minimum of 2 years, going on to 3 years, and in fact with a career trajectory that would take them to a diploma or degree level. So from 1 year training to 2 years to 3 years and even a 4 year training that would then lead to paramedic training. At the moment we have just under 400 paramedics in the country, where, as I say, about 11,000 of the 17,000 emergency medical practitioners are basic ambulance practitioners, and there's a register for each one of them. They are regulated by the Health Professions Council of South Africa. The third, as I say, is equipment. So there's the regulations then also recommend precisely what type of, and the number, and the quality of the equipment that should be available on each ambulance, depending on the nature and the function of the ambulance, what type of equipment should there be on those ambulances. And then lastly, the infrastructure of the ambulance stations. Now there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done. Now the recommendation then is that the other problem with emergency medical services, because it's not regulated, anyone can operate an ambulance, an emergency medical services, because there's no licensing that is involved. So we're recommending that there should be licensing about who can operate an emergency medical services, and then, as I say, what type of ambulance, who runs and manages the patients, and what type of equipment. So all of that, we believe, should be regulated, and the draft, the regulations that I'm referring to, that we are putting out, then covers all of that. Thank you, DJ.
Thank you, Dr. Carter. The next topic is just about the influenza prevention and control. Now, every time this year, most of us are away from work, because we don't hit it yet. I think we'd like to encourage South Africans to utilize the food. And hopefully, we have clear those in India that are So we don't normally encourage, but we'd like to use this equipment. It can improve productivity, because most people who take influenza who undergo vaccination, the similar influenza infections tend to withstand the harsh attack during this season. The next one is about the forensic lab. Even this one, I don't understand for having to let you be an overview of where we are with the target and for which lab, roughly, and report.
So, Chair, the way in which we are reflecting, the Minister referred to this earlier, that the targets that we are setting are extremely ambitious. At the moment, what we do is we measure the actual number of tests that are being done and those that are outstanding. Now, it's difficult to give you the exact numbers at the moment, because we are reconciling currently the number of tests that still need to be done versus the number of those specimens that we have in our possession that are also linked to a police number, a case number. And many of the specimens that we have are not linked to a case number. And when we reconcile between ourselves and SAPS, on their database and our database, we believe that the actual backlog would be significantly less. However, what we have been doing in the last year has been to significantly reduce the backlog. So the first thing that we've done, the Minister referred to that yesterday, the DG in fact also referred to it, in terms of graduates with chemistry degrees who have been unemployed, to train them to perform this work, and then to employ them. And we've employed 70 of those, and they've been deployed in the three chemistry labs that we have. Secondly, equipment. We've significantly increased the amount of equipment that's available in the labs. And thirdly, and more importantly, even with the resources they have available, we have done a system re-engineering. So that's, for example, in the Johannesburg lab, where we've not increased the number of staff and they don't have significant new equipment, they've significantly reduced the backlog, and that was more with systems re-engineering in terms of how they do their work, so that the actual backlog has been reduced. So the way that we in fact hope to measure the performance of the labs in the future would not be in terms of how many specimens are waiting, but how long, when you have a specimen that is with the lab, how long does it take to get the result? So that is what we will be measuring in the future. So the performance measure that you have is a new one. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Carter. This is the budget for this program. It is a 19 3 million for this financial year, and it will increase slightly. All these functions are functions that are performed nationally, so we don't have a grant in this branch at all. That's why what you see, honorable members and chair, it's our budget at national level. There are no transfers, it's just our budget at national level. The next one is about hospitals, human resources. This is a problem that comes from the doctor. The previous one, the primary health care is a family fund, which is rented by Mr. Murat. This is Dr. Kata, it's about developing policy, delivery models, clinical protocols for hospitals and medical systems, but also alignment of academic medical centers with the health workforce, training of health professionals, planning for health infrastructure to meet the health needs. The first one is about the central hospital, which we have this already. Yesterday in this day, I just brought to you the next one about access to care resources. We just finished the presentation of the package of care resources. And I want to ask Dr. if you can just give an overview of one of the problems, what led to this, because we have established that we, as a country, we do not have enough specialists. We start every single tertiary hospital and render the services that we require. So we had to look again at the tertiary services as to how we can rationalize but also improve the quality of service. And as we can then see an overview, what is the concern in India and the members.
So just over a year ago, in late 2012, a National Tertiary Services Task Team was established and appointed by the DG. What it did was, in fact, to go and look at what tertiary services are available, not what the name of the hospital is, but what actual services are available in those hospitals in terms of both the number of specialists, but also what the specialists do. So, for example, you have a hospital that is designated as a tertiary hospital or central hospital, but if you go there, the services that you're supposed to rent are not available. So if I can give you an example, if you take the Nelson Mandela Academic Hospital in Mthatha, it's designated as a central hospital. It's supposed to have the same services that you would expect at a hospital such as Floriskeer or Tigerberg Hospital. But in fact, if you look at the actual services they provide, more than 50% of the services they provide is in fact district level services, services that can be provided by somebody who's not a specialist. And the same applies to many of our other hospitals. In fact, there are many of our provinces that once you look at the availability of tertiary services, they are extremely poorly provided in provinces such as Mpumalanga, Limpopo, Northern Cape, especially those provinces that do not have universities. So there's a significant backlog in terms of access to tertiary services. Now, it's quite important geographically, because it means that if you happen to live near Cape Town or Johannesburg or Pretoria or Durban, you will have easy access to tertiary care. But if you happen to live in one of the more underserved or rural provinces, you're going to have difficulty getting into tertiary services, and therefore, if you have complicated illness, you're likely to die and not get to hospital. So the question of ensuring that we have the full package of care in all of those hospitals that have been designated as tertiary hospitals has been quite critical. So we've done a complete analysis of the whole country, what services are available everywhere, and we are now developing a tertiary services plan for the country, and hopefully during the course of this year we will have that, and also identifying exactly which hospital services need to be improved and strengthened as indicated on the slide.
Thank you. And one additional policy is that today the team wants our ears. The team met with the service in the country to establish from them how they can help us improve access and give this gap that is the type of Raj, and of course we use the bit of disease as a basis of engagement, but we'd like to go up and reach to the church and see how we can improve access, and we will be doing things and better, and find out how they, what models we think would work best for us. What is seen, because of the burden, Limpopo and Mbalang refer to Gauteng, and what has to happen, the Gauteng wants to build those ports. And our view is that the grant that we have, the service grant, should actually cater for that, meaning If you come from Mpumalanga and you are teaching and you go to Gauteng, you don't have to have any transaction because the grant, the funds that we are in for Gauteng has already taken care of the Mpumalanga residents who are doing services and equally for people who come from Mpumalanga. And equally, once again, if you come from Northern Cape and you need the services, the grant, because if you look at the grant that we allocate to housing and refugees, they actually are higher. So they should actually accommodate the business. I think that's one of them. The second one is a difficult one, but I'd like to present it so that the committee is aware of it. We have a significant proportion of people come from Zimbabwe to teach in South Africa. They come to take care of the So it has put a significant burden on the city. And I don't think when you give you the demographic profile, it's on the basis of the South Africans. You don't factor the sort of illegal immigrants or the analytics or we've not factored them. But they account for a significant portion. They put a burden on the health. So we still have not resolved that and then as to how best we can improve. The next subject is about the quality. Like we have the Office of Excellence and Compliance. Yesterday we discussed with the length I want to do. The Workforce Staffing Northern Standards, I'm asked for Dr. Peters to explain what wise and and what is it that is done for different levels of care, and what is it that would bring the next 2 years and Parliament interest
in? Chair, WISEN stands for Workload Indicator of Staffing Norms. It's a WHO initiative, and it's a very important initiative because previously we've never really had a scientific way of determining what is the staffing need in a facility. If you go to any hospital or any clinic today and you ask the staff, what is your problem? The first response you're going to have to hear from them is, we're understaffed. It doesn't matter how many nurses or doctors they have, whether they have too many or too few, the response all the time is going to be, we're understaffed. So how then do you determine what is the real picture? So what WISEN does, it looks at, depending on the burden of disease and the population of that particular community and the number of patients that you would expect to come to that facility, how much time would a nurse or a doctor need to spend with the patient? What is the patient contact time? The next thing is, once you've seen the patient, you need to do some administration work. You need to record what has happened to this patient. So there's an administration function that is linked to this. This person also needs to do some other administrative work. So not all the time that is spent by the nurse or the doctor is spent sitting with the patient. The staff also take leave, whether that is sick leave or training leave or whatever other types of leave. So that is also taken into account. Also, you don't have all the days of the year available for you to see patients. Then not every facility is a 24-hour facility. Some facilities are 8-hour facilities, some are 12-hour facilities, others are 24-hour facilities. So all of this is taken into account for every type of staff member in the facility. whether that person is a clerk, or a nurse, or a doctor, and the different categories of nurses and different categories of doctors. So for each category of staff, administration as well as clinical staff, we then work out for each facility depending on the demographics and the burden of disease and the workload of that staff, and that's why this is called workload indicator staffing norms. It then kicks out and it tells you, for this facility, this mix, you need so many clerks, so many nursing assistants, so many enrolled nurses, so many professional nurses, so many doctors, and so many specialists. and then it also then works out, as I said, depending on whether, irrespective of the number of hours that that facility is intended to operate. And at this age, what we are doing is to develop minimum and maximum levels and then to provide guidelines. And we are in the process of working with the WHO, or we've agreed with WHO that they will assist us to convert the data which has now been ratified. So this work that I'm talking about has been done over the last year or longer, together with people who have been trained in all the provinces, and they've been part of task teams and workshops and work that have been done on the ground with clinics, applying the norms that they've ratified the norms. So these norms have been ratified up to PhD level, and they will now be converted to guidelines, which then one can apply. And I can tell you that we've started doing that, and we've in fact found facilities where facilities are in close proximity, where one facility is understaffed, another facility which is closed by all the staff, and we've in fact made recommendations about how to redeploy staff between facilities that are overstaffed and those that are understaffed. Now clearly we need to do this for the whole of the health system, taking that to tertiary level and central hospitals. So that is the next tranche of work that will be done in this area.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say that, like I said earlier about the certificate of need, we'll also go back to see the principles that apply in the certificate of need from a clinical perspective. When we discussed with Treasurer about budgeting, they said it would also be helpful to look at the budget. For instance, when we look at the budget, because what we saw in three provinces, Chair, I won't mention them again for now, my answer, mention three provinces increase their staff establishment over a period of 3 years by 5,000. And when we dig deeper to check, when we dug deeper to check as to what the ratio of administrative and professional staff, there were more admin people than other professionals. In fact, the former Auditor General did an analysis, we did an IFT report, showed that the professional staff, the nurses, had only increased by 2%, doctors by 1.8%, and the admin by, I think it was 200%, sure. By 300%. So it's huge, more what admin than it is towards the professional. So at the moment, we are trying to fix that ratio so that we have more professionals also available. But we also look at the technical staff, which is not your clinical staff. Your admin staff would be like your IT, your clinical engineer, people that you need also. If an equipment is broken, there will be someone on site to fix it, your clinical engineer. Or IT, if your computer is not working, there's someone to fix it. So, and also your data capture. So we did it for that purpose also. But we also found something interesting. When we were developing the human store for health, the ratio and the between your professional staff versus enrolled nurse and assistant nurse, but that said, we had more professional nurses than we had enrolled assistant. Everybody is supposed to be the other way around. Because the professional nurses are supposed to be the chief, but no, let me use a different example. Not chief, it's supposed to be the commander, and then the others are supposed to be soldiers. So here you've got more commanders than you have soldiers. Mm. So we want to get the proportion right as well. So this work has helped us because we are trying to to, if you have quite professional Latin hepatitis, you can start saying that you need two, not five. And then we then recommend that the other three can then be readmitted to other
hospitals. You are not now talking about which is always registered with the reference with COVID complaint of. In her offices, more doctors, nurses in particular, they are in head offices of health, and we use the word very bloated. You are not mentioning that, and I don't know whether you're going to be sorry for.
No, you're right, you are coming to it, because part of the reason, we first wanted to say what, how should a facility be staffed? So that as we recommend that people move to facilities, it must be on the basis of having done this exercise. And we still can identify this increase that I have identified was precisely because most people are sitting in administration. But it's not only professionals, but in a lot of admin. More other people in administration.
So, Chair, this was a proposal. The next one on the standard, we discussed the standard and about nursing, like our team, we did an audit of the college, the nursing college in the country. I'll just analyze it quickly. Three issues that we need to correct and fix. The first one is the status of the college themselves. The infrastructure, and the second is about the proximity of the college to the clinic. If you look historically, we have a college in a setting where the clinic is in a clinical setting. Then the nurses don't have to travel long distances. So we're trying to see whether that can be resolved in some of the facilities. The third that we're trying to correct is the aging population of children, people who teach. We've seen that increasing. Some of them are going into retirement. So we're going to have a problem at some stage that we won't have enough trainers of nurses. So that's sort of what we're trying to address. That will help us as you look at it. There's a new law that says nursing must be part of higher education. It's a law that was passed by a Department of Higher Education. As a principle, we said it's okay, but it should not move nursing as an academic exercise where people are taught in a classroom like the minister said. We argue that the first 2 years must still be in a clinical environment so that we don't move away from nursing being a bedside training. So those are the details that the chief nursing officer is putting in at the moment. The compliance with this law is supposed to be next year, and we are working with the higher education, we actually set up a task team with higher education to see what implementation is, including if we have to extend the implementation to get our college right. So this is the budget for this. This is probably the biggest in terms of budget. If you look, the first one was the HIV AIDS one, which has a first over 1 billion in terms of the one. This is the second one, it's 18.9 billion, almost 19. And it is largely because it is special services, which I said are supposed to deal with the referral issues. It is about the infrastructure and professional training. It's training, it's special services, it's infrastructure. And all of those rent themselves, up themselves from. But it is the grant framework that can actually help us achieve what is needed. And we're still struggling for now with the grant framework, but as we develop full guidelines and all these other mechanisms, it would help us to improve our services. Because we're improving the counseling as well. It's not easy that we're getting there. But the most important is one about infrastructure, because we want to change the approach that is not about health facility change. Because if we just talk about infrastructure delivery, it means we're not paying for health services. So we would like to use that knowledge voice to say let us help facility change, so that is the basis on which we determine whether you need to build a new clinic, you need to build a new hospital, and where is the evidence, and why is the existing one not expanded or not improved, and there's an absence, a norm. WHO used to say that people have to travel 5 kilometers. You say 5 kilometers may be difficult for people who are sick. In rural settings, 5 kilometers may mean going over mountains and valleys, and we say we have to reconsider. For some who have access to transport, 5 kilometers is nothing. So we revise that down to say 2 kilometers is dangerous for walking. But 5, it's not possible for any person to walk 5 kilometers to access the system. So we review that information, but we will be coming back to that. The last one is about health regulation compliance management. It's about regulation of medicine, pharmaceuticals, and medical products, food control, and change in health products, health technology, but also about oversight for the secretary bodies as well as public entities, and ensuring that there's effective governance. So the first one is about complementary medicine, medical devices, electrical diagnosis, and so we got an amendment law that was tabled, I think, in National Assembly, but we think it informed that it's last. So the minister has written back to the chair of the assembly as well as the MPC. We just got a response from OCP today that it had actually not as yet completed to the MPC. So we have to retable it, have it retabled for the establishment of SAPA and move so that we have a much broader regulation for. And the precondition to this check is that our regulatory system is such that we don't train people. We don't have a system of trained people to regulate this product, which are fairly complex. In this, as we notice here, we differentiate between complementary and alternative medicine and African traditional medicine. We differentiate them and they get moved forward. Complementary alternative medicines are your Chinese medicines, the Indian system, medicines are Ayurveda, acupuncture, but we also have others like homeopathy and so on. These are not the same aspects of the only differentiate between these two cultures. And this will help us in the flow of make sure that we regulate them appropriately according to the practice and the science linked to them. Chair for food safety, as we said, we have tolerance, complete allergens. As you know, then I think this is a practical concern for us. Most of the snacks that are given to children, for instance, have tolerance. Sometimes parents cannot associate those tolerance to the allergic reaction that children have because they have no idea. So the best way to promote that is to regulate the tolerance that can be used in food or in medicine so that they don't use those that we know, the evidence of allergic reaction and other problems. Equally, we're looking at how best to improve registration. One of the criticisms has been the delay in regulatory approval. Now, what the SAPRA law is suggesting is that we can reduce these decisions by changing the way we approve medicine, by conducting what we call benefit risk assessment, but there are certain regulatory rules that we have to follow. The other one is about corporate governance. One of the problems that we have is that we have a statutory body that has been established. This is a great league professional. Your nursing council, pharmacy council, the dental therapy, dental technicians, council, allied health professions council, and so on, for all of them, including the traditional medicine council. We have a council. Now, those councils have to have sessions, government structures, actually the report. What is picked up with the council as an example? If you are a professional in South Africa and you register with the council, all that they want is for you to pay your annual subscription. That's all. As to where you practice, whether you're in South Africa, whether you're in business, you still appear on the register. Now, if you want to know the number of professionals that are practicing, you never have them, because they're important principle for planning. I know that normally when you talk about human resource for health, you talk about people who are trained. But when they come to practice, we don't know whether they're in practice or not. And we've actually picked up that most of the professionals, even nurses, that are in the UK, Saudi Arabia and so on, they appear on the register. But they're not in the country. But when you count the number, they are included. And it's in a way it's misleading. So what we're asking them to do is that they must start preparing their register in such a way that it shows exactly where the people are. It will help us with planning because we'll know that these are the people who are available for rendering services in the country. So those are the kind of things that we would like to meet them in. Equally for regulation, we'd like to ensure that most of the statutory bodies comply. This is the work of the Office of Health that are compliant. All these bodies here and all other members are going to come and plan before this committee. Their plans and their strategies. Our role is just an intervention. Just ensure that they produce their plans on time. They report on time. But they come independently to present to them. The next one is the OD. This one is not a fully established body, but it has a significant role and the register has an existence. The occupational health services is an area that we also are trying to improve because the health workforce is important. We use the statement that people don't go to work to be injured, to be ill, not to die. They go there because they want to provide their skills, so that make sure that the workplace is a safe environment for them to work. So we started this initiative, but the first was to at least ease the burden, particularly for the mining workers, because when the S9 workers have a problem for compensation, every time they need to get a compensation, they have to get into a training, a taxi, to talk to them. Now, we know the mining sending area. It's Eastern Cape, it's Limpopo, we know that. So we said, well, we need to take services closer for them, so that they don't have to travel all the way. They can, at least in the Eastern Cape, it would be easier if we have the services there. So those are the services that the Minister of Health needs. We will be coming to you about the establishment of NACIPA. Shell will try to reconfigure the services of the National Laboratory Services. Because there's a conceptual problem in the manner in which it was designed. It is for that reason that it has run into financial problems. So our view is that these institutions, NIOH, NICD, NCR, all of them are important institutions. They must get direct funding. At the moment, NHS has to render less results on a cost recovery basis. And then based on the funding. So it's not a sustainable movement. We've actually done that NIOH, NICD, MCR must get direct funding. And then NHLS must then run the lectures like we have with the Morgan, Lancet and so on. They are pathology there. But we say we have to look at that model because it is also making services very expensive. So what is the affordable model? So there's a trust team that the minister established between Treasury, Health, NHLS and access, that is the basis of what would help us provide for more. The next one is about the patient satisfaction survey. We would like to start working on this and we'll share the more with you. This is the budget of this. it's not a lot of things, it's not easy to talk just about overdrive and also a support. Thank you, Chair. I think I'll hand over to the CFO.
Thanks, Jamie. Mine is just to take you through the bigger part of the budget, which is our commission grants. And I think the next two slides will probably summarize most of the budgets. We've got three kinds of budgets schedules in the commission grants in the order. First is Schedule 4A grant, then a Schedule 5A and a 6A grant. The 4A grants mainly consist of your health professional training and grant, as BG Flame, and one of the National 30 Services grant. Now these two grants essentially are complementary to the budget of the process. So we do process on a monthly basis, based on a business plan and an approved business case to them. We also have a responsibility to monitor the expenditure, and if we feel that expenditure is low or not sufficient, we then go through a process with Treasury to either withhold funds or give reasons why we should not withhold funds, etc. But essentially, this is a very difficult grant to withhold because, as I said, it's a complementary funding to the equitable share of the provinces. The Scheme 5A grant consists of three grants, our comprehensive HIV grant, the biggest portion at about 12 billion, the facility revitalization grant, 5.2 billion, and then the national health insurance grant, which is a portion that is going to go to provinces, specifically to apply at the pilot districts. This grant also gives a business case and gives against business plans. In this instance, we've got more power in the water to withhold funds should the performance not be sufficient. The next grant is a Schedule 6A grant. Essentially, this boils down to our indirect grants, if you like. And the indirect grant is made so that the national department can implement certain programs on behalf of provinces. So in this case, we've got a national health insurance component at 395 million, mainly to look at the GP contacting as well as other specialists. The revitalization component is 980 million. The uptake, I must say, has been slow in last year. We've gone through a major learning curve in terms of this grant. The issue of this grant, Chair, and maybe this is where we'll get some assistance, is that the way it gets allocated as part of the capital budget. And we see that the need is not only capital but also maintenance and refurbishment within provinces. So we're lobbying Treasury to give us the flexibility to have this grant split between a maintenance and a capital portion. As it stands now, it's very difficult for us to account all our maintenance activities and capital expenditure. So that poses a serious audit risk for us that we're trying to mitigate. And I suspect that as we mature in this grant, we'll also find that provinces would be in the same predicament, where we're not asking them to build new facilities, but rather maintain what they've already got. So I think probably in the next year we'll have to mature this grant into both the maintenance and the capital portion. Coupled to this, we've also in this grant got a health technology portion where if we're able to assist provinces with some set equipment, then we will assist them based on that. The other one is the HPV components. It's there for 2 years. It's 200 million for this year and for next financial year. I think the Minister and DJ have spoken to this quite considerably. So our conditional grants that we transfer out to provinces basically 30 million. And that grows to 35 billion over the period, and what we're keeping at national as a generic grant is 1.5, and we're staying the same over the NTA period. I've put in this neckline just to give an indication of growth rate in these grants, and you'll see that growth for the health professional training grant is 6% for year on year compared to last year. On tertiary services grants, about 5.7%. The HIV grant grows quite considerably by 16.9%, and it's an effort by Treasury to compensate us for the loss of funding, I think, from the PEPFAR program on the grants. Especially, you won't find this in your back. I just added it as an explanatory slide overnight to give you an idea. But I'll add it. The RIPA grant grows very slowly each year, as you can see. Over the MTF, mainly because we we as national, we factor some of the portion at a national level, but also I think we call that expenditure hasn't been all that quick over the last few years. I think the Treasury has taken a view that the growth should be lower over a period. The insurance grant usually grows quite steep. You'll see it 48 to 70 million, but then it sort of ends up at about 5%. And the same with the national health grant. It grows quite a bit, 42%, but that's because of the once-off addition of the HPV components that is there. The next few slides, Chair, just talks to the breakdown per province and where most of the funding goes to. So on the training grant, you see that Gauteng gets Gauteng and Western Cape, as DJ said, get the biggest portion by the KZN. The total grant allocation then is 2.3 billion. The next one is your tertiary services grant.
If you look to say need proportionate, how can you have the four general hospitals without a big proportion? And Western Cape has a two. And I don't know if Chief Albert is truly open in social. So we have Chief Albert to truly as well. Chief Albert is truly as well as the King of Washington. And then if you look at Eastern Cape, they also have the Wakatu Sudu, as well as Nelson Mandela Academic Hospital, and Free State. So you see the full kind of arrangement. But if you look at the other provinces that do not have the training institution, their locations are much lower.
Thank you. Then if you move to the tertiary service grant, I think as we explained, that Gauteng and Western Cape has got the bulk of the allocation, followed by AGN again. The HIV AIDS grant is also spread across provinces. You'll see that especially AGN has got a good part of the allocation due to the big uptake in the grant over the last few years, followed by Gauteng, and even the Eastern Cape's uptake has been considerable. This has also been affected to some extent by the formulas in terms of population growth and etc., which also impacted on some of these allocations. The rebate grant is based on current projects that are there. You will see that the 60-17 allocation has not been allocated yet, and we're still validating the business plans that we find from provinces and also to evaluate what the potential contractual obligations would be over this period. The insurance grants are comparatively small, but it gets broken down and allocated to the pilot districts in each of these provinces. So just as a quick overview or quick summary of this, is that our total budget for 14-15 years is around 53.9 billion. It grows on average by 9.3%. To 9.4 billion over the MTF, and then of this 33 billion, 30 billion accounts for the conditional grants that go to provinces. That's quite about 88.7% of total budget. So we have retained, as I said, the 1.5 billion as an indirect grant to spend on behalf of provinces for the infrastructure, MHR, and HPD. Our compensation grows by an average of 7.7% over the MTF. Our business services by about 14.8%, but mainly that is because of the vision of the HPV vaccine grant that is there. I thought I'll just quickly touch on the non-negotiable species of humanity. I think that also mentioned yesterday, just to give you a background of what non-negotiable seem to or would like to do. We found about 8 months or so ago, 2 years ago, that there's quite a number of provinces that are unable to pay for the basic services, being like the vaccines, the body tests, blood, etc. So we found that some of the causes of this is that allocation
I
don't
know whether
members do have this
scope.
No,
we don't have this.
Yeah. Oh, you do have
this one.
The 10 years.
No, we don't have.
What is our district figures?
We don't have this. No, we don't have
No, you can continue, Steve. Adam, did you bring it with or?
Thank you, sir.
Actually, just to recap that, I was saying that the non-negotiables, the reason why we bothered with it was that many provinces were able to pay for basics like vaccines, laboratories, and labs. And we found that many of these items that make up vaccines, etc., are not adequately budgeted for. So you find provinces typically have enough budget just to cover 10 months. They would then try and roll it for 2 months, which then either could result in overspending of budgets or a big accrual that gets accrued throughout the financial year. And come April, they try to catch up again, pay for 2 months, and then the same cycle continues. So there's been a general poor cash flow management within the provinces. We've introduced this to make sure that we, in a sense, ring-fence or earmark certain budgets and certain items for these non-negotiables. We also found, obviously, if you look at trends over the period, that your personnel growth, your personnel budget and expenditure has grown at the expense of goods and services. So you'll find many provinces typically finance their personnel and generally cut goods and services even further. And after the next opportunity, I'll show you the analysis we did by some provinces that have actually grown negatively in real and nominal terms on their goods and services, which then puts additional pressure back on non-negotiables as well as your other sort of within the current expenditures. We also saw that even when you earmark certain programs and funds and you negotiate funding by, you know, a national level, and when it hits the province, it either does not get spent on the intended purpose or the province uses it for other purposes. So we're trying to get Treasury to, in the budget allocations, earmark these funds and in some way try to legislate it, you know, so there's better control over this. So we've identified a number of components that we call non-negotiable. They relate to infection control, medical supplies, medicines, lab services, blood services, food services, security, laundry, equipment and maintenance, infrastructure, vaccines, HIV and TB. And if you understand the financial system that under each of these, so if you understand the system that each of these components, they're the chart of accounts. So infection control will be made up by a number of accounts that would then, you know, sort of be added up to reflect infection control and clean it. And same with that. So provinces were given templates, we workshop the chart of accounts many times with them. We actually update it on an annual basis so there's conformity in reporting. So that if contain reports and evidence, we know it's based on a number of accounts, and the same with KGN, etc. So I think we've come to a point where we on a monthly basis get these reports, we assess them. I think we've established some kind of culture of reporting on this matter. I think it's good. And I'm sure that we will get you further as we go ahead with this. So, Chair, from my side, that would be the major issues on the financial. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, PG. Before we can fire some questions, then we have just five stretch. I would say smoke break. But I'm not expecting anybody here to smoke break. Thank you. They to say now. This budget, things are being the figures that are attached to the presentation. Maybe there may be some other things that have been
to that which we may have forgotten yesterday. But my humble request is that I would like to call members to order. If they repeat what they say, what if it's more of a thing. Except one person that may be disadvantaged and is looking at me, one member, and well, we have to see how we deal with that. The second thing is that today we're going to have a serious challenge of transport. Serious challenge of transport. Last buses are at 6 o'clock. So I would think that we must be done the latest by 5 to 6. So I'm sensitizing you so that you understand. And I want to put upfront, as you will be responding to you asking questions, also respond to the recommendation that maybe in some of the areas that you need more clarity. I don't know whether health is. In certain technology, we use members would free to communicate with the department or put some other things in writing so that when they come back, they are then able to respond when they come back in another time. So that is that, honourable members. Now it's your turn with the understanding of what I've just put to you. And the first hand is the honourable Fish. You teach me your name, honourable Sam. Yeah. I see that the three heads for now. Okay, those are the four honorable members with hands up, and over to you. Thank you. Honorable.
Thanks, Chair. Well, I was looking at the time. I'm not sure the practicality and the feasibility of the 5 to 6. We'll see how far we can go. I don't know why there's no transportation, because there should have been a prediction and an arrangement made that in case we go beyond the time, we would have ended, so that we are not restricted to do our work on the basis that the institutions are able to provide transport.
Can I just respond to that? Sorry. The citizen is in Kitchen Lake. The office can just interview, so let's relax and that's what we're taking care of.
No, it's fine, sir. No, just raising it as a concern, but it's fine. If they can be intervention, it's okay. Well, one matter that ATG has just went to raise is a general observation on the APP itself. One is that, as you know, and I did confirm yesterday, that on a quarterly basis, you'll be expected to submit quarterly reports. And then on the basis of that, we have to use those quarter reports to do an oversight on how the department on a quarterly basis is performing on the basis of this APP. The point that I'm raising home is that when I look at the APP, almost 50% of your APP are annual targets. You have about 105 times, and more than 53 of these 305. I was doing the calculation. It's the annual target, which means there's even one program where there's only one quarterly target, which means when on a quarterly basis must be doing oversight, it will still be 0000000. And will only be in a position to know what has happened at the end of the year. I've seen some of them, yes, can be annual target, but there's a substantial number of them that are not necessarily have to be annual target, can be divided in a quarter and be supported on a quarterly basis. My feature is that if the department can go and review that, so that it enables our work to play that oversight to the easier, rather than because when you come on a quarterly basis, you keep saying, you know, it's annual target, annual target, annual target. So very little that will do on a quarterly basis from an oversight perspective. So there are general comments that I've made an observation on. And then coming to some of the questions that might require a response. On program one, under both documents, they are not, somewhere they are not talking to each other, this one and the presentation. The average turnout in times in terms of treatment policy. This document took about 5 months. The presentation today is talking about 4 months. I'm not sure which is which. This is the correct one. Maybe we can just have a clarity so that they talk to each other, the document and the presentation. Under the same program one, so just a clarity, because there's been substantial, there's a reduction of 2%. What is the cause of the reduction, what informs it, so that we've got an understanding of but they are also new, there are two new sub-programs, but regardless of the new, two new programs, the budget is gone now. The issue that in the first measure that I was raising, one of the critical issues about legislation. There's a number of legislation that the ATP says you are going to be bringing. But they are not the target, it's annual. Yes. Which means we'll be sitting here, we can't plan when are we, when possible are we expecting the deal to be done. Because it says annual target. It means you can table it in February. Or in March next year. As long as we've tabled it, how long does it, Parliament take? It's not more your business. Yes. So, and sometimes it tables and we're made to rush because there's never been a time frame. But even the time frame on a quarterly basis, when you submit your report, you're in a position to say, where is the bill? Because they've promised to take it at this point. But because there's no timeline, a timeline is annual one, it will make even our plan in terms of whether the committee were required also to have our own plan. And our plan will also be informed by your plan as well. But where you are not giving us a clear target, even when our planning will also be not spot on in terms of the target. And then I want to go to program. There's a program that deals with I just want to, if it's possible to share with us the five central law speaking that you'll be targeting this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the names here, so that we've got an understanding what are those, so that when we decide to plan some oversight, we know how to plan it. Is it based on which hospital to say? That is thing applies with the nursing colleges, the five nursing colleges. The other program, I understand you did explain that the drop of the primary health care. But when you explained today, it confused me. The confusion was that he said, no, this is your work in the office. It's got nothing to do with the practical work on the district in the province. Which the explanation is still was that no, the drop is because work is done down there. I'm failing to understand the response of history and today, how they comprehend to each other. The issue of pressure that or burden that are placed by these neighboring countries, Zimbabwe, Mozambique. I'm surprised that you national as well, you say you don't have a solution to the problem. Because we've been raising this thing in provinces. You know, there will be public hearing by treasury where provinces will be invited. And provinces that are Mpumalanga, Bupo, Free State, and for Swaziland, Northern Cape. They've been raising these matters with treasure. And treasure was saying, no. That doesn't affect the budget for health. That's what they were arguing. And their argument was saying, no, the budget is based on a data that national departments collect in provinces. And then therefore the data includes, you see, everybody that visits health facility. Where is from Zimbabwe? They get captured into the data. Because it's not only the names, it's the number of citations. That's what they said. Then they said on the basis of that data that the National Department collects and provides treasure, it then is used as a basis for allocation. You see? You are also arguing the same thing that we have been arguing in provinces, and treasury has been telling us a different story, that because the department, when that presentation was, when treasury argued on this, he never said, no, the story that you are telling provinces is not an accurate one. Okay. And we're under that impression and belief, you know, it means it's like that. But now we must be in a position to see how best to deal with it. What is the problem? It affects a province in a very, very big way. And then the grants, the CFO when was presented, was saying one of the determination for the allocation of some of the grants, like the one for HIV AIDS. It's a question of population. But when I look at the populations, the allocation, it doesn't show that in other provinces. If you look at Northwest, Free State, it's got a higher budget than Mpumalanga, and Mpumalanga has got the highest population of the two provinces. Just put an example. So I'm not sure what other criteria beyond, but just mention one. You never mentioned what are the other criteria that are being used beyond population, because this one doesn't reflect the population as the main one. And then lastly, the issue of the revitalization. The issue of the revitalization grant as well. Is it informed by expenditure or is it informed by backlog? I'm raising this because the provinces who are very small, but their budget is very high on the vitalization. Is it informed by the historical problem of the infrastructure in that province, or is it informed by the expenditure that the more provinces spend, the more they get? Or what exactly is the story? And then the last issue about this, the norms standards that you're saying you're going to cassette is for infrastructure, so that provinces are in a position to follow it to the latter in terms of implementation of infrastructure. When one of the big witnesses in the plan is that you know the target, when this gas is going to take place, so it's then forever, and what will be the implications of it if there is no target, because the target is annual. What happens between the process of the gas thing is an annual target which might take place in February next year, what happened to the infrastructure? Has that been discussed and agreed upon with provinces? Because they might do a co-slow, because maybe they won't agree with you. They go slow and nothing happened at the end of the day and people suffer. Is there a consensus so that for a bigger understanding so that when these things are not happening, how then do we play our oversight? Because there are provinces that are receiving. Some provinces wants to behave as if South Africa is a federal state. And therefore, they want to do things according to their own, not according to the national norms and standards. So then they will go slow and services cannot be rendered and all those things. One. Two, those norms and standards, they include quality. And what system are you putting in place to monitor that quality services provided? Because the issue is that they will build a clinic 2 or 3 years down the line, the clinic is as if it was built 2 years ago. I've seen some of them. The clinic that I know in Mpumalanga was built, 6 months, the ceiling collapsed. You see? And the department had to start issuing a new contract to put the what you call the sleep. So is there a system national that is part of these nonsense standards, you will be in a position to monitor the quality of the infrastructure that provinces are providing? Correct. They last long, and then we don't find ourselves going back from time to time within a short space of time, must go back and rebuild. Not even maintain, go back and rebuild, because the infrastructure cannot even be maintained. They are in a very bad state for it to say you can rebuild it. But when you look into it, the age, it doesn't deserve to be in that particular state. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you once again for the presentations. They're very, very informative. I just have a few questions and I'll go through them quite rapidly. The first place is child health. Now we know one of the most important duties we have is to protect the health of our children. We know that this is a global priority. The DGs reminded us the UN MDGs are moving. One around child health, going forward, reducing mortality by 2/3, is a huge challenge. But we see a reflection of that priority in many of our plans within the NSDA. My question specifically coming to the APD is that, you know, if you look at reduced child health, we need to look at strategic tools. And one of the best tools we have is the Integrated Management of Childhood Illnesses, or IMCI, that was developed by UNICEF and the WHO. I unfortunately didn't see that in the narrative or in any of the published indicators. And I just wanted to find out, you know, why that was left out, because I know there are many tools, but this is a particularly vital one. The second one is related to tools for a child and particularly neonatal health. You know, particularly newborns is particularly important, and we've seen tragedies like we had at Maputo Lachi in Mpopo, where we lost 9 babies, tragically, and avoidably, I would say. And so obviously neonatal services are really important. I see though that in the indicators that when it comes to the neonatal strategic objective, you know, what you use it to measure is simply the actual neonatal rate. Perhaps looking at, for example, the proportion of neonatal units that actually meet adequate norms and standards would have been a good indicator to put things to that objective. And perhaps seeing how better to align, particularly this one, the strategic objective with the performance indicator. The next point is on the maternal mortality. It was really interesting that the maternal mortality ratio here is 269 per 100,000 live births. But if you look at the report of the National Committee for the Convention on Inquiries into Maternal Deaths, they quote in 2011 157 per 100,000. The DHIS, the Diagnostic Health Information System, quote 145 per 100,000. So there's a discrepancy in data. I think for us to be able to exercise our oversight duties, we need to have full confidence in the veracity and the accuracy of the data. And that kind of discrepancy is quite large. So I just wanted to find out, are they concerned about the quality of data used to report any of these statistics that we should know about? The next point is on the emergency medical services. I'd like to thank Dr. Carter for elaborating on this aspect of the service delivery. Just wanted to find out, though, with regards to the training, you speak about a two-year diploma for emergency care technicians and then a four-year degree for emergency care practitioners. The concern is that if you look at the way the training is currently being run, where it's sort of in-service training and people accumulating short courses along the way, they can actually be actively engaged in service delivery, obviously participate in the economy and develop professions. If you take those service personnel out of the services for 2 years or for 4 years, won't we run into the same problem we did with the nursing colleges and nursing training? We've actually taken people out of services instead of keeping them in. That is the concern. Is it perhaps a more innovative way where people can continue being engaged in services and full train as opposed to having to go to university for 4 years, for example? Fourth, and I'm almost finished, in terms of tuberculosis, again, we know that this is a huge part of our burden of disease. There was a strategy that was released on the management of drug-resistant tuberculosis. It's about centralized centers, decentralized centers, all the way down to community level. And I think that's really important because multi-drug-resistant TB, and particularly extensively drug-resistant TB, pose a huge public health threat to our communities. And so we need to ensure that our communities are protected. Yet again, I didn't see mention of those centers. I see on KCCA it does mention some NDR strategies, but it doesn't mention specifically those centers or speak to that particular strategy, which is so critical. And I just wanted to find out why there was perhaps that sort of oversight. Second last question is, I'm very happy that DG spoke about the integrated health service plan in Program 1. This is because oftentimes in healthcare we look at a silo way of delivering services. So we deliver in silos and in compartments, and of course many of these issues are very, very, very cluttering. So I think the DG may mention contamination, water contamination. You know what happened in Bloemhof and how that contamination resulted in diarrheal outbreak. And so obviously interaction with the Department of Water Affairs and the Ministry for Water and Sanitation is really important. The question is, in terms of integrated health service plans, particularly in terms of sanitation, how far along are those plans? I mean, when do we envision there to be a mature plan of integration of services across the province? Final question. We live in a very unequal society. We have one of the highest Gini coefficients in the world. And with inequalities, we of course have health inequities. And those health inequities drive the social determinants of health that the Minister spoke about yesterday and the DG spoke about today. When I look at ACP, I see, however, only one or two paragraphs on the social determinants of health, and it's so important. Would there not have been more emphasis on seeing how we can actually address those social determinants in the plan? Would that not have been a better strategy? And maybe if I can finally for you, Madam Chair, just on the DG, they've been commissioned on social determinants of health globally at the WHO with Professor Michael Moore, and also in countries like in Brazil where they had a national commission. Is such a national commission for the social determinants of health that focus not just on narrow risk factors for NCD but broadly on the social determinants of health or to be called for, would DG support that? Thank you.
Well, let me also hasten to welcome the presentation, the annual performance plan. And secondly, I acknowledge that we also appreciate the 33 billion annual allocation. I think it's a positive step towards the achieving full universal medical coverage for all South Africa, regardless of the person's social standing. And that is indicative of government commitment to work towards NHI, which is for the positive indication. would also want to, perhaps in the form of a recommendation, that the department and the ministry should try to indicate spending patterns at provinces, in addition to what they have already provided us with, the allocation at province, so that we are able to measure and to oversight of what has been allocated and how provinces have been spending on a quarterly and annual basis. That would be my most welcome. Secondly, on the program 6, health regulation and compliance management. We here at the department is planning to establish an extra entity called South African Health Product Regulation Authority. Wouldn't that bring extra financial burden over the department? And because I'm all in all, currently we've got about 12 entities together, with about 5 health entities and 7 statutory councils. I think it warrants some research as to whether the overlapping functions and roles, mandates of these entities as well as the statutory councils, to come to a determination whether there's a need for an extra entity. So perhaps we need also to look at that and say, and advise accordingly, whether does that bring additional financial benefits. Thirdly, under Program 5, well, we've read here that, and we've listened attentively, that the ratio between administrative personnel and specialists is a bit skewed. Perhaps it will also be necessary that we do a research on what is currently the ratio between that. Should be a position to quantify and try to find proper balance between non-professional and professional staff in the department. For instance, in Ireland, we learned that the ratio between, for instance, you have to use a doctor nurse ratio for a doctor for about 5 nurses. However, we need to learn from such competitive lessons and studies from elsewhere. And once we have made a determination of that, the ratio across different professional occupations, we'll try them to arrive at a stage where, in the light of the skyrocketing recruitment of non-professional personnel, there is a need for to impose a moratorium. As to whether would that be against government objectives to create jobs and all of that, will have to be advised on the basis of the research that has been conducted by the department, and to consider whether there is a need for a moratorium on non-professional administrative personnel. But I've already mentioned about the spending patterns in provinces. The department says, in terms of Program 2, that they intend to establish National Health Research Observatory. Good. There's a need, of course, for continuous innovative initiatives like this one. But like the previous question, wouldn't that be an extra burden? And as I said, what is the role of this National Health Research Observatory vis-a-vis existing entities and all of that? Last but not least, with really need to help us in urging what Honorable Mashalela said about the NHI, and they need to get a sense of what minimum normal standards are there in terms of national health insurance, as well as the pilot project that are run province. The department must provide us with a baseline on the checklist of these minimum normal standards and the criteria that has been developed by the department to measure if there's progress in respect of those pilot size. And I'd like to recommend that that will empower the portfolio to consider if there's a need to undertake study visits with these different HI prototypes, because we need to understand and measure the way that we as a national assembly are assessing and monitoring on a regular basis. Lastly, this also is a recommendation that to empower and to capacitate new members of the portfolio committee, there's a need that we need to be provided to this NHI founding or concept paper, so that we are able to know what kind of an animal we're dealing with at National Health Insurance, and understand its founding mission objectives, so that we are able to measure and to evaluate in terms of the milestone that the department has set to itself to see if we're working towards realizing the objectives of the National Health Insurance. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The first question would be the National Tracking Commission to regulate the healthcare in private sector. I think out there the people are crying about that, and the sooner it is done, the better for everybody. And secondly, we need the annotating of social causes of disease, and also ways of combating that, just as a checklist type of thing, where the society can be able to see that this is what can create problems, and maybe some of them they can try to help to avoid. That's very important. And the National Nutrition Supplementary Plan is not what it's supposed to be. I know it's the Department of Education competence, but the health of our children and what they eat is of paramount importance for us, because that causes them to be underage, is because they don't have the necessary. It's designed not underage, put it that way. It's because they don't have any proper nutrition. And you are culpable if our children are you're supposed to defend them from this. And it is really frightening. The government is spending billions on this, but they give children everything back. There is supposed to be a menu, but it is not actually followed. And they just make money out of it. I know practically in trying to fight this, so we should intervene in this one and quickly, not to wait for some other thing. And also the diagnostic laboratories in the hospitals. The norm, I think, now is outsourcing to Lancet and the other people out there who are actually making money. There was a problem of them, some people outsourcing and charging other provinces of exorbitant amounts and all sorts of things. It's because maybe the department abrogated the regulatory mechanism for this, or actually making sure that it is done in-house. It will cut costs tremendously, create jobs for, and because people will be trained to do this, not for exorbitant profit, but to help reinforce the curative part of the national, or the diagnostic part of the National Health Service in preparation for the NHR. And I think there's also the question of food safety. I don't know whose competence is this, because there is nobody who wants to own it other than it is this department's competency to make sure that food safety standards are maintained. Then you find that you just talk about colorants and some of them I would like to understand are carcinogenic, but we simply just eat and allow our children to eat this thing. They should be banned actually, instead of just saying, well, let's remove this colorant. So they are of no nutritional value whatsoever. They just feel us, feeling up maybe, I don't know. But I don't think in other countries they allow this type of thing to be sold to their children. What our children is our under duty to make sure that it is the correct type of thing that they eat. And so they, for food that got residues, toxins, and maybe even allergens, but nobody cares. We just sell them out there and make money. And what happens if there is a scare of food poisoning from who's going to do the analysis of what is the cause? And even in the agricultural sector, things are just sold just because somebody will buy them. But people just buy because they don't know that they may be buying diseases. And when this thing happens, then we'll be sorry. I shouldn't take more chance. That's what I'm saying.
Just three short questions. On program number 4 under primary health, you have touched on the improvement of environmental health services in all critical districts. This is one of the areas that I am very frustrated about, because our metros were in the locations and in the squatter are filthy. Now, and our observation has been that the metros are just, nobody is sitting on their necks. I don't know, have inspectors, where do they start so that from the Department of Health, is local government, their scope. You spoke about the shortage of tertiary hospitals, the shortage of specialists. The shortage because one brain pain, or they are not being trained. They leave the country with brain pain because of the remuneration. But I don't want to think that they are not trained. They don't, their country is not of the last one, I'm a bit disappointed on page 78, was mental health is money. Though when I was the trainer, I used to say, I don't care even if they pay a million for mental training and qualification. I've never, because it's always considered that a thin line between sanitary and sanitary. All of us here, that's what they used to say to them. That's correct. Just that. Hey! That's what we were told. I'm raising this because, honestly, that's not it. I'm raising this because it has been an observation on my side that mental health is a bit, I don't want to say neglected, but mental health in terms of infrastructure, in terms of human resource, in terms of training, what is affected because of this new method of training. And the other thing which I would have thought is our factor here is that, remember that in rural areas our people, they think that a person who's mentally ill, they don't know they're bipolar, they think that could be wished and even taken to a traditional healer and all that thing. I would have thought that a more elaborative and informative
a paper on mental health maybe in the next time, but it is important that if we would have unpacked the awareness about what it's important that we go back to our communities, in particular the African people who still believe in some of the things that are not accepted. I always say, in finishing, I always say, when we are debating the issues of gender struggles, I always say, you go to medical institutions. I'm going to how we must ensure that our people, you go to medical institutions, you will find the percentage or the number of males versus females. And you'll find that the highest number, I don't know now, it will be males. And those people are always say, those people are not bewitched. It's because of the patriarchal which all of us are a victim of. I'm making that example because I think it is important to go to communities and explain, because it's quite a huge number. It's a whole basket of factors of things that are affecting our and mental health. I think it's one of the areas that I don't think we are, maybe because of a number of things. So I would have loved that way. Maybe today you won't be able to do that, but if we can just be told and make an example. I know there's one mental institution in PE, there's one in Grahamstown where it also catered for state presidents, preachers. How many mental institutions are we having in the country? And province by province, I know it's one of the sore points in me, the issue of the mental health services and the whole package surrounding it. Thank you,
honourable chair, honourable members, for the comments, suggestions, the recommendations. I would like to. Firstly, start with the comments raised by Honourable Member Mahalela, and start by saying that you were referring to the budget, the reduction in the budget. We have been engaged in Treasure, and they did an analysis to show us that because of the budgetary pressures and the fiscal strain, all departments had to review their budgets. And for us, where we make a cut is the problem one, because that is administrative. We tend to avoid cutting budgets on programs that are service delivery oriented. If you check, we've avoided that. Program one is about administration, and without cutting the, not, I mean, if you postpone buying furniture, for instance, it won't do much harm. You can have used existing furniture. If it's about reorganizing, because it is in program one where you'll get, let's say, visits. We say, if people travel, we change policies, they, everybody travels, economy, everybody drives a small the one that starts with an H, a very small one. Everybody travels, meaning we introduce austerity measures ourselves. So we started with that, including in instances where you have large delegations, depending on our responsibility to the country, we say the delegation gets reduced. If it's training, we'll assess whether is it economic to send too many people to train abroad rather than having people train. So those are the things. So if we cut in program one, it is for those reasons. But we also do this on a regular basis. For instance, if we think we're not going to spend money, we send it back to Treasury so that it can be an opportunity for other priority areas to be funded, maybe for the rest of government. So we tend to do that, but we do it in discussion with Treasury on an ongoing basis. Chair, the areas about legislation, I just want to explain. We get requested on an annual basis by the the head of, is it head of government, the deputy president, to submit the legislative program for the year. And when we do that, we sort of look at what is feasible in terms of the number of laws that we think will be implementable in Parliament. But we also recognize that there are certain processes that must go before the bill even gets tabled in Parliament. Now, it is those processes for which we have control over that we think we can put targets. And I want to, by way of illustration, explain how so. When we start drafting the bill, the process is such that it has to first go to the foresight cluster for discussion before it even gets tabled in Cabinet. And when it goes through foresight cluster, after it has been approved, it then sets before Cabinet Committee. And that will be a week or two after foresight cluster. After Cabinet Committee, then it gets approved by Cabinet. That is the first phase. And then we send it out for public comment. Following public comment, we integrate the comment, after which we then table it again to the foresight cluster, Cabinet Committee, Cabinet. Now the period between Cabinet and Parliament, it then goes to the State Law Advisor for certification, and it's an engagement between ourselves and them on an ongoing basis until they say yes, it can be approved, it comes to Parliament. So those processes, I think we can have the timeline. But the processes for which we have no control is the parliamentary processes. It's very difficult for us to say, because we've attempted that before. We wrote that the bill will be approved by a certain date. And we've had an experience, and I'd like to just refer to the previous committee process, whereby it said it was discussed, and there was a problem with taking when it went to the provinces, for instance. Came back, they had to... So those processes we have no control over. So sometimes it becomes extremely difficult to then write quarterly titles for that. Because then, if the process of Parliament takes 6 months, and so on, I would have written something that I can't account for, and for which Parliament has far better control. But what we try to do on our part is that in that process of a discussion of bills by Parliament, we avail ourselves. So that we're available for those processes, whether it be public hearings, we try to go to all the provinces when public hearings are held and so on, so that you can also participate and also understand the comments from the general public and the concerns and the issues, even the provincial dimensions and so on. So for us, we need your guidance, because we can only say those timelines that are under our control. Beyond that, we can't.
I was referring to the process until the table of Parliament. I don't know, that's why I said, after the table of Parliament, no more your control. But I was referring to say, the deal that is happening. But for ourselves, to be able to resource the plan, we must know, in terms of the attack, we have to table in Parliament. That's what I was.
Thank you very much. What perhaps we will do, Honourable Chair and members, because most of the bill has actually advanced, like one that was already tabled here, we can just say that this is its status. We can just explain the status, because we've already progressed for most of them. So for this program, we didn't write any new bill that we're going to start from scratch. And but for others, we can still say what the expectations are, maybe for this, maybe next year, because we try to reflect them for the coming year. The one that I wanted to refer to also is about the National Health Insurance one, because that one still needs a white paper. So what we've also noticed is that we'll write a bill, but if it needs a white paper, then we can't even start the drafting process. So we'll be cautious, but we will do that. Every time we prepare a program, for the program we'll sort of outline the timeline for each area for which we have control over. But even that, sometimes even with Cabinet, with the best of intentions, cabinet refer some of them back and say, not happy with this or the other, go and consult other departments as well. But now, the DPME had introduced yet another process, which is new, that they are now going for every bill that comes their way, they are going to do a regulatory impact assessment for every single bill. Now, that's a new process. It has just been introduced, so even for every bill, even with the best of intentions with those targets, it will depend on how quick or how slow a presidency conducts the regulatory impact assessment. And I think we will be conducting for all government departments. So it's another element. We'll just reflect, but also add that it's sort of a rate limiting step on our part. But these are the timelines that we propose. Chair, with regard to the five hospitals that are targeted, I'll ask Dr. Carter to mention them, including the nursing colleges.
Chair, so the five hospitals are Nkosi Albert Luthuli, Steve Biko Academic Hospital, Universitas Hospital, Fullerstein and Tuggerberg Hospital. So those are the five hospitals we target. Unfortunately, if I was in nursing colleges, I'm concerned I don't have all those names, but we will provide that to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. The next question was about my response to them today. You still consistent, I'll explain why. Yesterday, what I was trying to explain and clarify is that if you go to specific programs, if you go to program the HIV/AIDS maternal child women's health, there's allocation for the creation of primary health care work streams. Now, the primary health care work stream, one is on school health, the other one is on district health specialist team. Now, their budgets will not reflect on the health budget only. It will also reflect on the provincial budget. But we say, what is it that the provinces must do relative to the district health specialist team? So we will give you more or less what is it that the province has allocated, what is it that they've done. But their budgets will not appear. They are allocated in accordance with equitable share. The second is the ward-based primary care teams that the minister described. Now, because we don't appoint those teams nationally, we don't keep the budgets nationally. But what we do, we provide guidelines, for instance, on how the ward-based should be, we provide tools and so on. Meaning our role is not supportive. And we tend to try to influence how the provinces reallocate so that they can still implement the primary health care approach. So this is what I was trying to explain. Now what I was also trying to raise here is that 98 million is probably adequate for us to come up with guidelines, norms and standards, draft law if necessary and so on. So we don't need more than that. And in this particular program of primary health care, we don't necessarily have a grant, because it's not necessary. And what we've also tried to do, we go to the infrastructure grant. If you think primary health care clinic needs information systems, we will tell those who are doing infrastructure to allocate money for the clinic. So what we do, we don't want primary health care to sit with money if money must be with infrastructure. So it will make it like almost like a nightmare. Infrastructure sits with all infrastructure budget, whether it be for clinics or for hospitals and so on. But we'll still count it as part of primary health care if it's to improve the clinics. If it's about quality and it's about the quality of clinics and it's sitting in another program, we'll also count that in. But for this program, we think that this amount is adequate. We don't need more, because for the length of the work they do, it's adequate. We don't need to allocate more for it. Chair, the burden of neighboring countries. I'm going to say something that will get me into trouble, but I'll say it anyway. I have spoken to the DG of DECO, the honorable member. If you check we contribute from SASU to the neighboring states. And I don't think as a country we've explored that vehicle as a mechanism by which we quantify the number of people who utilize the services and say on the basis of that, this is what we think SASU should forego this amount. Let's say in Mpumalanga you have, let's say, 50,000 Mozambicans who access services. Or in Lesotho we have so many who access services. You say, if your SASU allocation, because this money the South Africans give to those countries, you say, we'll take this proportion because these are services that people from this country, I mean, it's something that I have presented to DECO to say, with that help, perhaps we do this. Because frankly, it's not all provinces that are affected the same way, but others are more affected than others. Gauteng, for instance, is incredible. I mean, 30%, 30, between 30 and 40% of the people who you said come from the neighboring states. And what they do, and I just want to show you, when the women present, and all we know, they come, and I think the primary health care system must have worked very well, because when they come with their local health card, you know the card, for immunization, they bring it to our facilities and they present it. They don't even hide. So you have a mechanism by which you know that they are from this, because it's written their own country and clinic and so on. And they don't hide there. They come and they are open about it. So it's a big challenge, but I don't know if it's a proper thing, but I've had maybe it's an option. I don't know, Honorable Matanela, it's what presented to you. It will probably get me hubble, but I thought maybe it would help resolve this problem. The organization of services and data. I think if you look at the state SA data, it doesn't tell us about the foreign, the info of patients who come from neighboring states. State SA data doesn't reflect it. And I think this is it, but our facilities will do that. Because at the moment we started the process of patient identification, meaning the means of identification when you get into a facility, your ID number. So surely those who come from other states will not have an ID number. So we'll be able to tell you that in this facility, so many of them utilize. So it will be for the rest of the country. Then we will have that data for the first time, actual data. That's at the moment, the provinces use the, it's actually a tick list. You know, the tick sheets. But the tick sheets are just tick sheets. They don't differentiate between foreign and non-foreign. They don't do that. But this time with the patient identification program that is just started, we will be able to know. And maybe it's the basis on which you can approach the DECO and other and treasure them. The other option, honorable members, is that some of the countries are beneficiaries of the development aid money, for instance, Global Fund. And other mechanisms, GAVI for instance. And South Africa does not qualify for GAVI. So it might be that we share data with GAVI to say, you know, we immunize children from these countries. So some of the immunization money we can claim from GAVI. So those are other innovative initiatives that we can think of. We have grant programs from our clients, for instance, malaria, TB, HIV. But those are not for specific groups. It's not for the whole population. So we'll have to look at whether we can come up with those ideas. It's one area that is working well that we've not explored whether it's generalizable because it's for very, very specific areas. The grant, the determination for allocation, I can't remember what that was. The population, oh yeah. The I think that the HIV, actually, to be honest, Mpumalanga's figures must be revised. Specifically because Mpumalanga has come number two, so it's not just population basis, it's about burden of disease. Now Mpumalanga, because it's number two, it must reallocate to accommodate the increase in the burden of disease. So it will be both burden of disease and population. So we also rely on the Treasury guidelines. Treasury has been discussing the revision of the equitable share formula. and we've discussed the principle of equity as a basis of allocation. But I don't think it has worked, frankly. I mean, we still have intra-provincial disparities and inequities, which I think from the data that we have from the district presidential review, you can see those differences. So we want the formula revised accordingly. So we've been in discussion, but we've not concluded that work with strategy. Revitalization as to what informs it, as well as expenditure, backlog, spending patterns. The way it works, the provinces give us a list of facilities. They say, we'd like to build it, but those should be based on it. They also go on to say, we want to do maintenance. The only condition is that we say, okay, based on the list you've given us, we will accept the list. We don't have the mechanism of interrogating whether is that list a good list. We don't ask questions. We trust in what they give us, and we say okay, and then we publish it and gazette it. So it's an honest submission. So maybe we need to go back here, and that's how it has been. However, honourable member, what we've done in the past, it's the first year. Because we've audited all the facilities, we now rated the facilities. Now, we will show you that this facility, the infrastructure, is at 50% function, meaning a province must go and allocate for this infrastructure and improve it. So we use dashboard, yeah? And then it shows you what the status is. So we can show you for every single province what the dashboard says and what the status is. It's quite intense because it will tell you about the status of the ceiling, the lift, if they had a lift and so on. So it's quite detailed. So we would like to use that and enforce it, but we still negotiate. But we also have a formal process with the provinces whereby on every now and then we have what we call Tech NHC. It's a meeting of myself and the HODs to discuss infrastructure and other policy issues, including the non-negotiables. But what we've seen increasingly is that we set up what we call PMSUs. PMSUs are project management unit in the province. And they're supposed to have the engineers, but they're not performing at the same level. And our proposal is because I've set up a steering committee last night, that every province must have a similar steering committee where the provincial HOD with the partner follow the spending pattern. But honorable members, on this one, on rewrite and the deadline, so we can share that with you, because then as we do the oversight, we can actually check whether are these the facilities and so on. We can come back with that and do a presentation. Now the standards, indeed, honorable member, what we did, and again, it's also because we've already progressed, we've already gazetted the norms and standards. Now, because they are bulky documents, I think it's huge files and multiple files. What we decided to do, and we decided that for any province to implement this, it's going to require a lot of investment again in resources. So we said we'll use sort of a much more supportive role. What we do, we develop tools to train them on how to use the norms. Because our view is that for them to comply, it's better if they understand those norms and standards. Because just to give them norms and standards, our view is that it's not enough. So we have started that process, and we have them on a CD. They are quite intense and it's huge kind of it's detailed and it's elaborate. So we'll share that with you in a CD, but with a guidance on how to read and follow them. We encourage, for instance, the provinces to have the PMSUs. We're helping them with the selection of engineers. As you know, this province where we are has taken all the engineers that were needed. I think about 275 of them. I can't remember the number. We're all here. so we're trying to get them redistributed to us from, if possible, and work with the academic institutions to beef up the other provinces to build their capacity. On child health, yes, indeed, it's a global priority, but I just wanted to say that actually we are implementing IMC. What we don't have to do is just repeat every single statement about that, because it's what we're already implementing. We have established actually what we call a development partner initiative, where we have UNICEF, WHO, UNDP, all the UNFPA, so we meet on a regular basis, because we also want to make sure that they harmonize their support, because what they tend to do, most of the UN agencies, everyone comes with their program, they want countries to implement, and it undermines our efforts in the country. So we force them to harmonize, to come with one plan, and then we work together around the field. So we've introduced that. But honorable members, if you allow me, I know I refer to nonsense standard, but I also need to say that we've got a number of strategies. We didn't write those into our plans because now we're implementing them. And I just want to enlist a number of them, which will take me to the last point you raised about mental health. If you allow us, honorable chair, we'll share with you the mental health strategy that was approved towards the end of last year and we are busy implementing. We'll share the NCD strategy which we are implementing. So we have a strategy for each area so that we are much more focused. So we'll prepare almost like a package for each member of all the material. Because with your oversight, you also have to check whether we're doing all those things that are in the strategy and so on. For newborn, yes indeed, we actually, the approach that we took, we are saying for the district health specialist, it's also a program of equity. We've identified clinical specialists, but nursing specialists, like your PhD nurse, your advanced midwife and so on. Access to those specialists in this country is a problem. So we want to at least make sure that those teams are available in a district to provide support. We actually seen that they are making such an incredible impact in those districts, because they are able to go to the facilities to respond to train. So we can give you case studies, honorable members, case studies of where they are working very well. But we can also report on you where we are still struggling. There's one particular specialist that is rare and it's still a problem. And I think it's a debate about whether an anesthetist is needed in a facility or in the hospital, or, you know. So there are proposals that maybe we may consider training anesthetic nurses. We may also consider having instead of having anesthetists, especially maybe have diplomas for some of the doctors, without, because then it's not as bad as not having an anesthetist. I mean, those are options that have been discussed, but at the moment it's a very red skill. We'll share with you the data that we want a complement of 7 in some provinces, 4, other 5, some 3, and so on. The world is actually not in shape. I mean, we not succeeding there. So for other provinces, in Mpumalanga, it's easier. We tell some of the specialists, even some of the foreigners, they are beautiful animals, and they all are willing to go because they want to see animals. So we have to use different strategies. For maternal mortality, honorable members, can I just explain, there's a difference between maternal mortality ratio and maternal mortality rate. The rate, you use a particular model, and there's something called systemic. And the question for us is, it's an approach that sets as the user, which is okay, we don't have a problem. The data of 269 is actually both what is happening in the community and what is happening in our facilities. It's maternal mortality for the country. So that is fine. It's data that is released by SES, and it's correct because the methodology is right. But what we tell you, and what the confidential inquiry into maternal deaths, the committees, they tell you about deaths that happen in our institutions. So SES has both. They have and this is a subset of data of the overall. So in essence, that's what I was saying, when your mortality is 300 for the country, so half of that happens in our facility, if you look at the breakdown. So we are saying, for what we can do in our facility, we can reduce that better. And that's where we'll put the emphasis. However, it doesn't mean we can't intervene in communities. We can still do something about it. The emergency medical system, I'll ask Dr. Kara to respond.
To make a few comments about the question that we were asked lastly around training. The first is, I pointed out earlier that the current basic ambulance assistant training is 4 weeks. Now clearly that's totally unacceptable, and the big problem is that many of our ambulances, there's a problem that we have in the Northern Cape, for example, is many of the ambulances have only one ambulance person on deck, and in fact, and that person would be a basic ambulance assistant. So one of the things that we are saying is, firstly, that all ambulances should have at least two ambulance practitioners, and we're saying that at least one of them should have the training. But the specific question was about how we're going to approach the training. So the way, the method that we intend to approach the training is that over the next 5 to 7 years, to ensure that the operational mix, staffing mix of our ambulance practitioners are 45% assistant paramedics, 45% paramedics, and 10% advanced paramedics, and the staffing mix should be regularly reviewed. The necessary agree that the training program must be offered, and this was a specific question, in a modular, two things. Firstly, recognition of prior learning. So many of these ambulance practitioners, like I said earlier, are people who have been in the system for many, many years. They've learned the skills through hard, practical experience. So recognition of prior learning is the one, and that already advances many of the experienced people into a bracket where the training would be short. Secondly, the training program must be offered in a modular fashion. Thirdly, that the options, there would be options for both full-time as well as part-time training that would be provided, and particularly also to ensure that training is available in rural areas, if more modern communication technologies in terms of training is also used. So we're looking at a wide variety of training methodologies to ensure that we train the majority of people who currently don't have the skills, but also to ensure that people are not taken out of the service unnecessarily long while they are being trained. And that we understand that we would need to phase this in over a period of 5 to 7 years because of the numbers.
Okay, thank you, honorable members. Regarding MDR, CBXDR, maybe let me mention that we have actually built these centers using travel fund money. Every province has such a center. So whether they are fully utilized is what we can examine and perhaps investigate and come back to. But we do have these centers. And it was, they were built using travel fund money. The next one about inter-region health service planning. Yes, we started the process. It's new. But it is also going to be driven by ministers, because there's an inter-ministerial committee that has been established specifically for that purpose. So we will work on the basis of that inter-ministerial committee. The commission on, and let me just say that on the commission, the WHO commission, actually I've been one of the commissions actually, including the real declarations that were passed and so on. So, We are looking specifically at the South African context, but there's also been policy development. I think that there are two issues that in approaches. One is that there's a policy that there must be health in all policies, meaning every government policy must have health as a policy stream. Like sports and recreation must have something about healthy lifestyle, and they must plan as to how they are going to help us achieve healthy lifestyle. Maybe come a policy that everybody must exercise 30 minutes every day, you know, and then another department must have. So we're working on that to say health in all policies. The second one is the one on they call it health through the life course. It means that the way we plan for health, we don't call an individual from before they're conceived. Because you start by saying that it will be contraception or not, and so we look after a baby or a woman when she's pregnant, a baby when it's born. We don't look at the life of a person through the life course. And then we see them again when they are immunized after that, we forget about them, except when they are ill, and we see them as adolescents if there's a problem of drugs, or, and then when they're adults, when they have NCDs. So there's this concept that we should look at health through the life course as a strategy, but we still disagree. So those are streams of work that impact on the social determinants of health in our approach. The next one about the NHI and so on, yes, we will present the report. In fact, honorable members, I have an appraisal of the NHI pilot site. We will send you the report electronically. It still be edited at the moment. And it will give you a sense of what has happened in every single NHI pilot district and where we are, where the problems are, and where there are good practice and experiences and so on. With regards to regulation, let me just explain about the SABRA and the regulation of SABRA. Actually, it's already law. The only problem is that there were some technical problems with the law, and can share that with you when you come to present to Parliament. It's actually about the regulation of products, medicine products. The other statutory bodies regulate people, the profession. This one is products and where products are produced, so that you can comply with good manufacturing practices and ensure that there are no contaminations and quality problems. But also, honorable member, I've actually conducted an assessment of I think 26 countries in Africa. We developed a tool to assess. And the common theme is that there's a specific way in which you design a regulatory authority that regulates medicine. And this assessment tool is I can also print that report so that you can see how South Africa compares with the other countries. So it was conducted a while ago, but we sort of asked WHO to do further. There's also a 10-country study that was conducted to compare developed and developing countries alike on how they design their regulation system, the weaknesses, the strengths. So it's a very important kind of set of data for members to just see where the country compares. Now, My proposal, honorable members, if you agree, we are still in this continent considered to be high. In fact, some actually rate our regulatory system along the same line as Australia, Switzerland, Canada, meaning they put us at that level. However, I argue that to regulate actually depends on the health system, the burden of disease, the size of the pharmaceutical market. Now, South Africa cannot be the same as African countries because we are the only country in the continent that makes formulations. We stop the production of APIs, but we still do formulations. We are one of the few countries that have capacity to, and we've got an industry, but a lot of companies in South Africa, whether local or not, but we can't be, even if we say we're in Africa, our regulatory system is still respected internationally. In fact, our scientists are the ones who established the WHO regulatory, the pre-qualification system, when it started from the beginning. So I just wanted to tell honorable members that we are still regarded highly. Even with the problems and weaknesses, but we're still regarded highly, and I can share those thoughts with you so that we can have a better sense of where we reach. Now, the question is, how do we skill our system? Even though we're regarded highly, our system is at risk. At risk because when we regulate, we rely on experts from universities. We don't have full-time staff. Now, this law is to say, can we change the model such that we have full-time staff? And I must disclose, there's a young fellow, honorable members, who are sitting at the back yesterday. He's got a PhD, he's unemployed. We are recruiting all of those with master's PhDs to train them so that they can be full-time regulators. The risk that we run with having experts in universities, so they're busy, they teach, they do research, and they do the MCC work part-time when they have time. Now, it's such a strategic area of importance, including what you said, honorable member, earlier about the control of food and food substances. This body must do exactly that. But we need to skill it and ensure that they can be empowered to do that. The next one is about the ratio of specialists and staff. We'll just get from the wires and data from this work that we did, what the ratios are. We've already done that, we can share the data with you. But we would also like to get any other experiences from other countries, like you suggested, Honorable Member. The point about the balance, we've demonstrated also that we still have the technical stuff that we need, finance, IT, HR, those are not necessarily, they border between admin and technical. When you say admin, we talk about class, basically, and people, you know, but here we're talking finance, IT, we have a lot of South Africans with those skills that are not employed and are trying to see how we can bring them into the work stream, even if we expose them to certain programs and so on. And some of the institutions can benefit from having them, and we've seen with some of the hospitals that is possible. The research observatory, I think the difference with the observatory that you it's not a research institution. What you do for people, because if you look at health, there are four streams of research that we have to conduct from time to time. It's epidemiological research, health systems research, and clinical research. Now, what we tend to do, we need clinical research for drug development. But we still need to conduct clinical research to understand whether the medicines that we have, do they work? Are we getting benefits? Can we do cost effectiveness? So we have to conduct those. But what you do, you have to identify which institutions are the best institutions to do that for you. And we have worked with the European Observatory. So what they do, they pull different institutions to partner and to twin. Because you have something like that in MRC, for instance. But you also recognize that MRC does not do health systems research. But health systems trust does health systems research. So what you do, you then identify which of the institutions will work with MRC, which ones the health systems trust, and so on. But you also have ARC, which is the Agricultural Research Agency, which help us to answer whether, for instance, we just finished very interesting work. We came with a law that says we want to do food fortification. Now they are saying, actually, even though we say fortification, the availability of those nutrients is very, very poor. So we may not get enough of the nutrients that we want because we have the way they formulate is based on processed food. So we have to go back and look at whether we have to revise the regulation. So you need some kind of answers for specific questions. So it's not a lot in the sense of investment, but it's just identifying which institutions are the best to help you. So we finished work on creating a database that will help us identify who are the best institutions in the country. Honorable members and chair, the next question was about, was it about nutrition? Northern Standards, NHI, we have reports, like I said, we do appraisals on annual basis. We'll give you the previous one for the previous year and this one, so that you can also compare between the two as to whether we're making progress or not. Honorable members, about empowering you, I would really like, if you allow us, we'll share all the materials with you, electronically and otherwise. Strategies, norms and standards, all background materials, we'll share that with you, if you allow us. National Crime Commission, yes, we wanted yesterday, if possible. We are waiting the results of the inquiry. The social causes of diseases, yes indeed, I agree that we might have to, and it's linked to what the Honorable Chair said, you know, about mental health. If you look at the problems of the social determinants of health, but also the mental-related burden of disease, HIV-AIDS by itself has a dimension to mental health related disorders. We've actually come up with an approach, and Professor Mary Freeman, I would like to really advise that he comes and presents to the committee some of our findings and some of the studies that we've been conducting, including the strategy itself, but and infrastructure, because we identify that every plan for infrastructure, we don't say anything about mental health institutions. So they want back to say in this fund for revitalization, it must also include mental health. So we'll then have that breakdown for you and show you so far how far we've gone. And share about the National Nutrition Plan. Yes, honourable member, indeed. we must also change our regulatory strategy for food and food control. We sat down between agriculture, health, as well as trade and industry to define rules, who must where, how. At the moment, when there's a problem, no one wants to take ownership. So we have to address that. But we would also share with the members the Sanhedrin study. It's a nutrition a study and surveillance that will help us see what is needed. The lab, definitely there's a problem there. We will come with a bill, share with you how we want to reform NHLS so that it's what it should be. But at the moment, it is a bit of a risk for us. And food safety, I'm going to ask Mr. Murewane just to talk about food safety and what we do and environmental health.
Yeah, honorable chair and members.
Excuse me, maybe also talk about, yes, I think this is one. I'm sure when the inspector, the health inspector.
The issue of trade food security, food safety in particular, as the DJ said, it is an area that targets a number of sectors. And I don't want to reopen the whole story, but if members would remember, story of adulterated meat that erupted last year from the Kambo. It took together the Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Agriculture and Food and our health. So it is a matter that is struggles within that. But within the department, the areas of food security, food control is more regulated work than we do. But this closely ties up a lot of members with the dirty cities and the filthy cities, and I'll explain why. You see, the department has in line with the constitution transferred the municipal health services to the municipalities, which was traditional what health inspectors did. And then you then expect the municipalities to then pass bylaws, particularly when it comes to trade sites. I mean, mothers and a few other farmers, I guess, are cooking along the streets. They spill water into stormwater drainages and the offered of other spider and stuff. Now, in order for us to make sure that we control that area, that is why in our APP, we've written that we write down the norms and standards for us to then guide the municipality to what is it that they must do. But in the municipality, the bylaws are not passed at the level of environmental health. They are passed in another area, particularly the economic sector, and also the special development areas. But then, you then have on our side also the need to have law enforcers, which are made for police, that are then people are picking those to arrest them. Ours as environmental health is more to guide, you know, regulate, guide and make sure that we and the municipalities then execute that. But we think that through the norms and standards, all those will come together. And the reason I link the two, I mean this with the food control is because in the same way we can only regulate the less the minister explains and can only tell what kind of food stuff would be regulated, what are the ingredients and stuff. But going beyond that, in terms of actual points of sale, and the bigger problem came at some point where some supplements were ordered from another country. When they landed at the port of entry, they did not comply in terms of filling them, in terms of the ingredients. But the inspector from the other department that is dealing with actual importation and exportation as a single transactional matter, found that the importer was okay for them or imported that. Whereas when it came to our unit, we realized that we can't allow the product because it did not match, not meet the particular standard. But even here, in terms of long-term standard, was also in the full control in the area, you know, the hotel services, municipal services. We hope that soon that we'll be able to address all these problems. So we only have to require more cooperative and cooperating with other sectors. Thank you.
Honourable members, the next question chair about shortage of specialists, whether it's brain drain, the problem of training or remuneration, actually they are well paid, I must say, because of OSD. The chief specialist and I think an equivalent of the DC Yes. The deputy, the senior specialist, principal specialist is the level of DDG. And so in terms of salary, I don't think it's a problem at the moment. What is the problem though is that the same way as nursing, the existing ones are becoming older, they're retired, there hasn't been a replacement strategy. The second problem is that the provinces, for people to be trained as specialists, provinces must create the registrar posts. About two or three years ago, there was a vacancy of 1,000 registrar posts in the whole country. And we went to Treasury and asked for Treasury to allocate money just for that. And Treasury allocated. Unfortunately, the funds were not in place. And in some of the provinces, they did not use it for that purpose. So we have to go back and look at what the status is now, review again. But we consciously checked because there was a report that was produced by the College of Medicine showing us if we don't intervene now, a few years down the line will be without enough specialists, but even those who train specialists. But some provinces responded very well by creating the books, others did not use the funds for something else. Mental health care, like I said, indeed, we share the strategy with you, and we will also look at some of the proposals about the breakdown. And just to add, without being serious, the same argument with mental institutions is also present in terms of the ratio. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gigi, and the team. I do think that you answered it with about our saying. I think it was correct for the state administration to have a portfolio on communication. Because, hey, although other people are ridiculing the thing, that we do have a cost to pay. The only thing is that with all the changes that we have, but we do have a good story to say. And I think the administration will really have a way of ensuring that we let people know what we are doing. We will come back to you as the portfolio committee when we deliberate at some point. One of them to ensure that in fact you have said just that you submit some of the, you will provide us with some of the information, which is going to assist us when we go and do our oversight. We must not go there, but when you feel in jail, you don't change. We must go there to see and why things were not done as they I want to make a proposal that in these areas where you say we've done this, in these provinces, it is possible. Because remember, some of these institutions are located within districts which are in, I'm making an example, O.R. Campbell, Justice, so that when we look into the whole picture of how do we develop our program for oversight, as quickly as said, that we go there being well informed and ensuring that the only scary point that I am worried about, and I want you as the department. So, why provinces give them money and they want this and you don't have statement. I'm saying, please, when you come back, tell us that this is what we've done. We know that here we had a witness, but we have improved it. Here is a pilot of what we are wanting in this province. The last area, which all of us we haven't spoken about from yesterday. I'm raising this because you have said it. You said the health, how we are going to monitor the health of a human being.
Ethiopia. You haven't spoken about, we are trying to develop a program that we will then go to basic education, because the children there are going to pass grade 12, starting from grade 10, 11, empower them. What do you call it? The teachers, or what do you call it? Career guidance. That's one. And maybe that will then go with the distance in nation coaches, so that they know. They have a passion, they know that should, whenever they pass, those that are there, so they are able to identify those that will have the capacity and ability, the skills of being health economists, those that would be having going to be, I'm worried about the, I don't want to be seen as being a specialist. Analytics, you know, we grew up in the sector, analytics were only males, and I don't know why. Maybe you do have female analytics, but majority, yeah. So I'm saying, as you, let's try and work with the Department of Basic Education, so that those children who are not going to have an ability, not because of their own making, that expose them to the next, to the health sector, nursing fraternity, this and that, so that we are then able to develop and assist the young, the youth, which are going to be the citizenry and the leaders of this country tomorrow. I want to thank on behalf of the committee. I want to thank the presentation, which was very informative, detailed, reader friendly. I'm saying reader friendly because I'm coming from a portfolio that I took, what is the, but it's because it was more academic, or maybe it's because I am coming from the health sector, but I do think that it will also assist members also to understand. I will be on the case on the information that you promised us, but top in your agenda is the act, please. I will try and check with the, if they do have comments, they must expose us, but it's going to be very important that we do have those. With those few words, I think we have done good. And thank you very much. Until we meet again, you can excuse us, and then the committee will finish our round up our business correctly.
Thank you, members. This is our first meeting with yourself. We appreciate the comments, the guidance, the suggestions. We'll do editorial because there are mistakes, and we thank honorable members. And that's when we have time to discuss more about the targets, whether they should be quarterly or annual, and what we love to see. We'll come to the proposal and present. Thank you.
Thank you.